as usual. We got it here today for this informal dispensation of collective discussion. As always, I must remind you that I am not the master. I do not own any of this material that I will be sharing with you today. It is the Supreme Enlightened One, the Lord Buddha, who is the master, who is my master. It is through him that I have been able to understand the Dhamma that arose in his mind, the Dhamma through which, the infinite compassion through which he expounded this Dhamma for the deliverance of all sentient beings. I am only the carrier, not the master, not the proprietor. He is the master. So prior to us all commencing, let us take a moment to pay homage to the Supreme and Enlightened One, the Lord Buddha.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Also, before we commence, reminding ourselves yet again why we are having to do this and why we have to keep doing this every time we gather here. This is because virtue is still not part of who we are. It is not part of the very fabric that constitutes our minds. Virtue, at this present moment in time, happens to be an artificial artifact that we all have to abide by, in the hope that the day will come soon where we will no longer have to observe precepts. With that hope and determination in mind, may the precepts that we are about to observe at this present moment help us to get there. May this be a stepping stone on our journey to cleanse our minds of the cankers of the defilements, in order that one day we will no longer have to observe precepts. So, with that firm resolve in mind, in order to observe the five precepts, I ask you all to chant the Namaskara 3 times and all together. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, Dutiyampi Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Saraṇāgamanaṃ sampunnaṃ. Pānātipātā vēramanī sikkhāpadaṃ samādhiyāmi. Adinnādāna vēramanī sikkhāpadaṃ samādhiyāmi. Kāmesu micchācārā vēramanī sikkhāpadaṃ samādhiyāmi. Musāvādā vēramanī sikkhāpadaṃ samādhiyāmi. Suramereya Majjhapama Dattana Veramani Sikkhapadam Samadhiyami. Tisaranena Saddhin Panchasilam Dhammam Sadhukam Surakhitam Khatva Appamadena Sampadetha. Okay, you may now all be seated. Most venerable members of the Mahasangha, members of the audience, as always, before we commence, let us take a moment to invite the devas, brahmas, spirits, demons and the dead, reminding ourselves of the fact that throughout our infinitely long journey in samsara, uncountable number of times we have been at the mercy of many of these beings who today are destitute in samsara, who today may not have the gift of Dhamma. Having been at their mercy, we owe them a debt. Having received the gift of Dhamma, it is now a prime opportunity to repay those debts by offering them what it is that we have today. By offering them the opportunity to find peace, to be at peace with oneself, and that is by inculcating the Dhamma that we all speak of and expound. So, prior to us commencing, let us take a moment to invite all those sentient beings, some of whom may be today born in the woeful plains and are looking for an opportunity to rejoice in meritorious deeds such as this. Perhaps the most that they will get out of attending this event is to be born in the blissful plane. And that may be all that they can do. However, from that point forward, they have the opportunity, among other beings who are already in the blissful plane, to listen to this Dhamma, to understand this Dhamma, to comprehend this Dhamma, to become a student of the Tathagata, and to cleanse their minds of raga, dvesha, moha, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. So now, as I make this invitation now to all the devas, spirits, demons and the dead, I want you all to remind yourselves of all those beings that you will have come across in samsara. Perhaps you may not be able to recall their faces or their names, and that is still okay. Just the thought counts. Everyone that might have been a mother, a father, a brother, sister, uncle, aunt, grandparents, nephews, or perhaps just your playmates who might have played with you in the sand. Whoever might have helped you in any way, shape or form, assisted you, been of support to you, whatever their contribution might have been to your happiness, let us take this opportunity to invite all of them to join us, to witness this meritorious deed. And for those who are capable, may they be able to attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana through the course of this very sermon. So now, as I make this invitation, I ask you all to extend that invitation in your hearts and in your minds to all those sentient beings. May they join us, may they witness this meritorious deed and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Samanta chakravalesu atra gacchantu devata sadhammam munirajasansa sunantu sagmokkadam Dhamma Savana Kalo Ayam Badanta Dhamma Savana Kalo Ayam Badanta Dhamma Savana Kalo Ayam Badanta. And also prior to us commencing, let us take a moment to remind ourselves that although today I am in robes, we are in robes, and you clad in white, Perhaps the way we are dressed, the colors that we are dressed in, may be a representation of our state of mind today. However, our state of mind today is not the state of mind that we have been in throughout samsara. And this is because we have not always had the opportunity to associate the Dhamma. We have not had the opportunity to associate noble and moral people. Virtually all our associations have been with immoral, ignoble people. Immoral and ignoble people who defiled our minds with raga, dvesha, moha, desire, aversion and delusion. And having been blinded in avidya and tanha, ignorance and attachment, we may well have offended, abused, slandered and desecrated the Aryas, the noble ones, the Samma Sambuddhas, the Paccheka Buddhas, the Arahatta Buddhas, Anagamis, Sakurdagamis, Sotapannas, be they on the path or having attained the fruits, as well as the Buddha's ministry, the Sambuddha Shasane. For any words, thoughts or actions of abuse, slander and desecration that we might have directed towards them, today, those deeds, thoughts and actions may block and hinder our progress in the Dhamma. So prior to us all commencing, let us take a moment to seek forgiveness throughout this samsara for any words or thoughts or actions of abuse and slander that I might have directed towards the noble ones or the Sambuddha Shasane. May they have the kindness and the compassion in their hearts to forgive me. And finally, let us all make a firm resolve. May through the course of this sermon, if there are any gaps in our knowledge, in your knowledge to the understanding or comprehension of the Dhamma, may through the course of this sermon you be able to fulfill those gaps and attain the noble attainment of Sotapanna. And for any of you who may have already attained that, may through the course of this sermon you be able to fulfill the subsequent stages and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. With that firm resolve in mind, I invite you all to prepare yourselves to listen to this sermon. Okay. Please feel free. Because the supply is intermittent, so we might have drops of current, so please feel free to switch them on when they go off. Because after all, we are not against the comforts that we experience through our bodies. There's nothing wrong with that. Because that is real. If you're feeling hot, that's very real. Whether you're a Sotapanna, a Sakurdagami, an Anagami or an Arhat, or even if you are a supremely enlightened Buddha, you'd still feel that. So that's not fake, that's for real. Physical discomfort, physical comfort, all of that is real. If you suffer from a headache, well, guess what? A supremely enlightened being will also suffer from a headache. If a backache hurts, if you find yourself suffering from an excruciating backache or a stomachache, well, guess what? A supremely enlightened being is no different. There are many times towards the end of the Buddha's life where he asks help from his chief disciple, from his chief attendant even, Venerable Ananda. Ananda, I feel thirsty. Please can you get me some water? Sariputta, I have a really bad backache. Please could you continue the sermon from this point forward? I need to go and get some rest. This is a supremely enlightened Buddha. So if he's feeling that, then I think it's safe for us to say it's okay for mere sentient beings like us to be feeling physical discomforts. So we don't really have a problem with the physical discomforts. The problem we have is with the mental, the psychological discomforts. The psychological pains, distresses, despair, moments of frustration, anger, resentment. This is what we have to deal with. This is what we have to find a solution to. Because a Buddha never felt that. An Arahant never felt frustration. You're never going to find a disappointed Arahant. That just cannot be done. That just cannot happen. If you did, then he or she is not an Arahant. Simple. Simple as that. So it's the mental realm that we are dealing with here. The psychological. And you all know this. Now, last week, I don't know how many of you were here, but we went into some detail about how we can penetrate this veil of pleasure by also contemplating on the Dhamma. And in the Buddha's dispensation, the Dhamma is nothing other than the dependent origination process, Paticchasamuppada. So I made an effort to explain to you and to help you realize that being able to penetrate the veil of pleasure, being able to see through it, see through the pain that lies behind, the suffering that lies behind, the apparent pleasure which lies on the surface, is the same as being able to contemplate on the Paticchasamuppada, is the same as being able to understand, comprehend the Paticchasamuppada, the dependent origination process. Because actually that's a process. It's a process. It's not a thing. It's not an entity. It's a process. This is a betel leaf. It's a thing. It's an object. But I couldn't pick up the dependent origination process and show you, look, there's the dependent origination. I can't say this is dependent origination because it's a process. Just as much as I can't show you the process of baking a cake. It's a process. I can show you a cake. I can show you flour, I can show you sugar, I can show you eggs, water, the oven, but I can't show you the process. You can watch me baking a cake, and if you're clever enough, you might be able to pick up the steps which are involved in the process. But through your eyes, you're not going to be able to see the process. You're only going to be seeing the very things that go through the process. You'll be able to see a doer who's doing the thing, that you'll be able to see. You'll be able to see the things that are used to make the cake, to bake the cake, but you're not going to be able to see the process with your eyes. Because a process is not something that you can see with your muscular eyes, through your physical eyes. A process is something that you see through wisdom, through insight. It's a knowledge. A knowledge does not have a color or a taste. There's no how do you feel about the knowledge. You can't say that because it's a knowledge. So I asked you all to try and find some time last week to go through last week's sermon again, because as I warned, it was a little bit heavy. But what I'd like to do today is actually go over some of the stuff that we spoke of last week as well as a refresher. And also, you know, this is what we need to talk about. Remember again, I've spoken about this many times with you. When the Buddha went into the forest, and I still haven't found out the English word for Atteria. So I don't know if any of you know. That's still on my to-do list. Rasa Hamguru will help me. So he goes into a forest that's full of these trees. Whatever the English word for Atteria is, that. It's full of these trees. And on all of these trees, there are lots of these leaves. So he goes into the forest and he only picks up a handful and he asks the question, monks, which is more? The number of leaves that I have in my palm or the number of leaves that you see in all the trees in this forest? And to which the answer is obvious. So the Buddha focused his teaching on what he had in his palm. Not that he didn't know everything else. He knew everything. That's why he's called the omniscient one. There is nothing that he didn't know. The limit of what he knew was everything that there was, that there is to know. And if there is something to know, then that he knew. So despite knowing so much, he chose, this is all I'm going to talk to you about because I am here for a purpose. I am the supremely enlightened Buddha and I am here for a purpose. By the way, I'm not talking about myself, okay? I'm speaking of the third person. Gosh. This is what the supremely enlightened Buddha said to the monks. I am the Buddha and I'm here for a purpose. And this purpose is again not to show you how to find relief from physical pains, is to find, help you find relief from this mental problem that you have, the psychological issue that we all have. So this is why he gave us the doctrine of the Dhamma, the dependent origination process. And I'll go through that. And also in our second visit of the dependent origination process, or perhaps I think it's the third because we've done a sermon previously as well, not just last week. I think at the end of last week's sermon, someone came and asked me, how do you connect the five aggregates to the dependent origination process? Where does all that fit in? And I said, well, the reason I didn't cover it in last week's sermon was because it was heavy enough just going through the dependent origination process. So I need to give people time for it to sink a little bit, to go back and revise. So perhaps we'll go over some of that. But before we get to that, have we got our basics right? We're talking about building 10-story buildings, multi-story buildings, and have we got our basics right? That's really important. How much merit do you do in a day? In a week? How much merit? Honestly. Or are you too busy to find time to do merit? Ping, right? That's what I speak of, merit. Meritorious deeds. Are you too busy to find the time to do that? Because that can happen. Particularly in a crowd like yourselves. Because, you know, you're all well-educated, well-to-do people. I think it'd be safe for me to make that assumption. But it's only an assumption and I don't mean to stereotype anybody. But it's just a safe assumption to make. Because it's usually a privileged crowd who's able to understand English in this way. And that we have to accept. Let's not hide from the truth. What can happen though is, oftentimes when you're in that kind of privileged position, you're having to deal with all of the world's problems. Because you're capable, because you're knowledgeable, because you know, because you can, people are going to rely on you to do lots of things. People who are less capable, people who are less knowledgeable are going to come to you for help. They're going to expect you to rule the world. They're going to expect you to make things happen. They're going to expect you to make the world go round. Am I making this stuff up or have you not found yourselves in that position? They're going to expect you to make this world go round. You know, it's probably the 2% of this country that make the other 98% happen. The privileged. Again, there's nothing to hide. I mean, that is the truth. That's the truth. Yesterday, there was a fine audience that I was able to deliver a Sinhala sermon to. There were we have a monk called Baddiya at our monastery, and a lot of the people that came to the sermon were his family and his extended family. So they came from a long way. I think he comes from Ampara. So he was here, and then I had the opportunity to come and speak to them for a few moments. And the reason that comes to memory at this point in time is because I was explaining to them why it is that I became a monk. Because Baddiya Hamdru Banthe tells me that some of them still have their opinions, and some of them are still dubious as to why this young lad of 18 decided to go into robes. And some of them are still unsure that he made the right choice. And some of them are still speaking to him in a way that is resentful. Buddha, you shouldn't have done that, really, should you? Look at yourself now. You can't do the things that we can now. So he says, Swami Nohasa, please could you come and explain to them, help them understand, because they don't realize how much damage they're doing to themselves by saying things like that. So as I was sat here, and I, about half an hour into the sermon, I said, would you all like to know why I became a monk? And everyone's going, yep, you loser. I bet you didn't have everything we had. So that's what they're thinking. And I said, I became a monk because of three problems I had. One, I had money problems. So everyone's thinking, ah, there you go. See, he had money problems. Then I said, I had food problems. Food was a problem to me. See, you could see people gossiping. Oh, I bet his parents were really, really, really poor. So they probably couldn't even feed him. That's why he came to robes, so that he could get a free meal. And then I said, I had women problems. I had women problems. This is why I came into robes. And as you can expect, there was a laughter across the room. People think, surely he's been to no good. He's been up to no good. So he's come into robes, and I said, you know, you do understand, right, that when you come into robes, you no longer have money problems. And they're going, yes, because we feed you. You do realize that I no longer have women problems, right? Yes, because, well, she's somebody else's problem now, right? And of course, when I was saying, one of the reasons I came into robes is because I had women problems, and I could hear an elderly lady from across the room saying, well, you know, it's good at least that you speak the truth, Swami Nohansa. And I said, indeed, madam. Because I have sought the Buddha's permission to sit on this seat and speak the truth and nothing but the truth. I have sworn, I have taken an oath to speak the truth and nothing but the truth, so I cannot speak false. I said, yes, it is because of these three problems that I came into robes, but not the way you know them. I had money problems. And the money problem that I had was, despite having all the money that I could ever want in my life, it didn't solve the real problem that I was suffering from. I had enough money and more. I think the number of people that I have helped out in my life, I can't even begin to count. The number of destitute people in Sri Lanka that I have helped out financially, I can't begin to count. But, you know, this is all old stuff. But this is what I was explaining to them. So now they're beginning to wonder, hang on, something's not right. So I said, I had money problems. But the money problem was, it didn't matter how much money I had, it didn't solve the real problem that I was trying to find a solution to. And then I had food problems. I said, unlike perhaps most of you, and I said, excuse me if I'm making a wrong assumption here, I've eaten foods that you will never in your entire life. But despite all the foods that I've been able to try out and please my senses with, I was not able to solve the fundamental problem that I'm now able to. That's why I came into robes. And I said, yes, I had women problems. Because it didn't matter how many women I was able to associate with, be with. It didn't solve the fundamental problem that I'm now able to solve. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is why I came into robes. So now they're all keen. Now they want to know. Now they want to listen. Because until then, they weren't prepared to listen. Until then, they were thinking, oh, poor you. And after I told them my story, now they're thinking, oh, poor us. Now they're prepared to listen. So, we should only speak the truth. And that was a detour, but when I said we should only speak the truth, and we should focus and not hide behind the truth. You know, that's why that memory came back. So it was a interesting event that happened yesterday, so I thought I'd share with you. So the fact that we're all privileged is the truth. So there's no point hiding behind it. But what can happen is, when you hold that kind of position in society, a lot of people will come to you with expectations. But if you forget that this whole world is nothing but consumers and suppliers, then only you are to blame. You will lose. Because remember, youth is not something you will have every day. Health is not something you will have every day. Well, let alone youth and health. Life is not something you will have every day. For as long as you have youth on your side, there'll be people who will be expecting you to supply them with certain things. Sights and sounds and smells and tastes and touch. For as long as you have health, you'll have people coming after you. Like a dog who comes wagging his tail when you have given him the promise of food, meat. Hey, doggy, doggy, doggy. He's only going to do that, wagging a tail, for as long as you have food to offer him, to offer the dog. When the dog realizes, he's just trying to trick me. There's no food in its hand. Then he's going to go elsewhere. It's going to go elsewhere. Because all the dog's interested in is, I'm hungry. I need food. It's a dog-eat-dog world, right? You've heard that before? It's a dog-eat-dog world. So this whole world is consumers and suppliers, ladies and gentlemen. We need to understand that. So the thing is, when we find ourselves in privileged positions, sometimes we can forget reality. Sometimes we feel pretty blessed. We begin to think, hey, I'm really fortunate. Look at me, I've got a really good education. I'm well to do. I've got plenty of money in the bank account. I've got a lovely wife. I've got beautiful children who are always there for me. So you think. I've got a beautiful wife who's always there for me. So you think. So you think. What are relationships? You give me what I want, I will give you a label. You can call me wife for as long as you, Mr. Husband, gives me what I want. You can call me husband, wife, for as long as you give me what I want from you. The day you are unable to give me what I want from you, you shall no longer call me husband. You shall no longer call me wife. This is the nature of the world. We have to accept that. We have to be able to come to terms with that. So today you might have plenty of money. Today you might have good health and youth on your side. But remember, all these things are conditioned. You're only going to have these things for as long as there are conditions that are in your favor. And when these conditions change, then you become worthless to the world. If you haven't found a way to stand on your own two feet, ladies and gentlemen, if you're continuing to rely, if your happiness is dependent on somebody else, if your happiness is not entirely a factor of how you feel about yourself, your state of mind, and your happiness is dependent on how somebody else feels about you, then beware. Warning. Beware. If you define your happiness by how somebody else feels about you, if you feel happy today because you think your girlfriend just said, I love you, beware. If you're feeling elated today because your fiancé proposed to you last night, beware. He can take that away just like that. If you're happy today because you have three beautiful sons or three beautiful daughters,
beware. They can be taken away from you. How? Just like that. Then what's it gonna happen? What's gonna happen to you? Aren't all the things that you find happiness in this world conditioned? Isn't everything that through which you seek happiness in this world either a sight, a sound, a smell, a taste, or touch? These things have to come from the outside world. Can you give yourself a sight? No, it has to come from the outside world. This is why you open your eyes, so the outside world can come into the inside world. You have ears. This is how the outside world comes into the inside world. You have five senses through which the outside world is constantly coming into your inside world. And if that is how you are looking for happiness, then beware. Because your happiness is dependent entirely on the outside world. Gosh, does that not send a shiver down your spine? Think for a moment about yourself. If you're in a boyfriend-girlfriend relationship, either now or perhaps in the past, if you've been in such relationships, if you found out that your boyfriend or girlfriend cheated on you, how much longer are you willing to stay in that relationship on his behalf or on her behalf? It's not nice that I break up with him because, you know, it's going to make him sad. So I'm still going to be with him. He's cheating on me, but hey, it's going to make him sad if I break up with him, so I'm going to be with him. Any of you done that? How many of you will want to be in a marriage if you know that you're being cheated on? If you know that your spouse is having extramarital affairs? Are you going to continue to be in that relationship because, hey, if I get a divorce, if I ask for a divorce, then it's going to make him feel sad? Are you really going to be like that? Come on. You know the truth. So if you're like that, how do you expect the other person to be? What makes you think he's so different from you? What makes you think she's so different from you? He or she grew up in the same world that you did, learning the same stuff that you did. From the very young ages, he or she learned exactly what you did, which was to find happiness. You have to go associate the outside world. If there is a day when the outside world does not give you happiness, then what do you do? Change supplier. We're all businesses. What is the sole purpose of a business? Make profit. For its shareholders. Aren't you all in the business of making profit? For whom? The other person? No. Ourselves. This is all a one-man show. A one-man band. We're all individual, single owner businesses. Now you do know, perhaps if you're in business, that when you enter a relationship with another business, you have to be careful. You have to study them carefully. Not just at the point you start that engagement, but also you have to continue to do research about the other partner that you've just gone into relationship with. Because you don't know what they may or may not do in future. What if they get into other business relationships which are not conducive to your affairs? Then you decide, no, that's it, we have to stop. Embargoes, things like that. Countries get involved, states, governments get involved. Because of notorious things that other companies do, you have to decide, no, that's it, we have to end this relationship because it's having a negative impact on us. Now, if you do that with your businesses, how do you think you act individually? Isn't this how we all work? In our minds? Single owner businesses, right? A business is heartless. Come on, you know that. A business is heartless. The people behind a business may have a heart, but a business is heartless. Now in this example, if you're beginning to see what similarities exist between a business and you, then ultimately, all I have to say is, whoever associates you, you know, when you start a relationship, just make sure you say the word, hey, beware, okay? There are certain things I expect of you. The day you cannot supply what I'm expecting from you, then, you know, I can't really guarantee that we're going to be there forever. Are you confident enough to say that? You find a girl, you think, you know, I really like her, let's get into a relationship. Do you think you could go up to her and be honest about why you're getting into a relationship with her? Are you starting this relationship up based on honesty? What's this relationship based on then? Pure selfishness. By the way, I'm not saying don't get in relationships. That's not for me to make a call on. All I'm saying is, beware. Because ultimately, what you're gonna find is, all we have around us is our consumers and suppliers. You're either a consumer or you're a supplier. Whatever relationship you have, parents, children, husbands, wives, girlfriends, boyfriends, employer, employee, it's all consumer and supplier. There will come a day when you are no longer expecting supplies. That day you'll be a great person. The day arrives where you're no longer expecting supplies. Now it doesn't matter what your supplier sends you. It doesn't matter. Whether it's soft words or harsh words. That's okay. I'm only here to help you. Speak to me how you like. That's fine. I'll help you. I'm here to help you. Because now you're only a supplier. You're not a consumer. That's what happens. Someone who's a consumer and a supplier eventually turns into a supplier only, not consuming. I'm not fussed about what you bring to me. I'll give you whatever I have. Take. Take. I'm not keen on what you have to give me. Whatever. If you have, give. Otherwise, it's okay. If you get into a relationship with somebody like that, that's a safe relationship. Because you can be guaranteed that that person's not going to dump you. So if you really want to get married with someone who's never going to hurt your feelings, if you want to get into a relationship with someone who's never going to hurt your feelings, who's never going to break up with you because you said something off the cuff which you didn't really think about and it hurt, you know, and it wasn't the right thing to say at the time and you regret it now but it's too late because you already said it. If you want to get into a relationship with someone like that, you're going to have to find an arahat to get into a relationship with. But the problem is, people like that don't get into relationships. Because the whole purpose of a relationship is what? Consumer, supplier. Consumer, supplier. Consumer, supplier. Do arahants have friends? No, they're not friendships. Associations. Not friends. The Buddha didn't have any friends. He had associations. Because when you have a friendship, you expect things from in return. Isn't that why you call your friends friends? Why is the odd man walking on the street not your friend? And the guy you can think of when I say, who would you like to ring right now? Who comes to mind is a friend. Why is that? Because the guy on the street is not supplying you with anything that you're interested in. But the first person that comes to mind when I say, who would you like to ring to have a chat with? Now that might possibly be your best friend. Because that person is able to supply you with the things that you're expecting from them. This is what friendships are based on. So again, you know, this is all practical advice, ladies and gentlemen. Nothing else. What I'm sharing you with right now is practical advice. Because you'll all have friends. You are all in relationships. Relationships much the very same to the ones that I was in. The very relationships that also brought me pain and suffering. But I was able to sever those relationships. But you're still in that battlefield. You're still trying to maintain and foster those relationships. So this is practical advice for those of you who are not able to sever relationships, but who are expecting to be happy despite the relationships. This is why I say, if your happiness is dependent on the outside world, then beware. Seriously, beware. Because remember, a relationship is nothing other than you scratch my back and I scratch yours. The day you stop scratching my back, I will no longer scratch yours. If that is the case, then remember that the day you stop scratching their back, they're not going to be scratching yours either. All relationships are based on selfishness. Sorry to say, I know you don't like to hear me say this. I know that. It's painful, it's hurtful to listen to somebody say, "What do you mean? You mean the guy I'm married to, I'm about to get married to, is selfish? He didn't propose to me because he loves me? You're saying he loves himself?" Well, I told you, I can only speak the truth. But there's nothing wrong with the outside world again. Remember, that's just the nature of the world. If that is your nature, why do you expect the world to be any different? You are just the same, right? Until the day you become an arahant, I'm not going to trust you very much. Is that a fair statement or an unfair statement? Okay, well, let me put it this way. Because it's not nice, right, for me to say I don't trust you. Let's put it this way. Do you trust me? Please don't nod your head this way. Because then you're mistaken. Until the day I become an arahant, be careful when you associate me. Because I still have a self that I have to maintain. There's a self that I foster. There's a baby Natasha that lives inside me that I have to feed. And when the baby starts crying, who knows what extent I'm prepared to go to. Until someone attains at least the first state of sotapanna, you are prepared to go to any lengths. Anything goes, by hook or by crook, I am prepared to get what it is that I want. If it makes you cry, tough, cry. Not my problem. If you have to weep, lament, be disappointed, frustrated, if you have to go and hang yourself, well, not my problem, go hang yourself. It's really harsh to listen to someone say that, right? But isn't that the truth, ladies and gentlemen? How many couples break up knowing fully well that, you know, the person you're breaking up with is really sensitive. And she may go and jump in front of a train. He may go and do something to hurt himself. And despite that, people nowadays break up over text messages. So I hear. Thank you for being with me for the last 5 years. Goodbye and don't contact me again. All the best. Love, Sam. XOXOXO. Beware. This is the world that we live in. No one brought you here, by the way. No one dragged you into this world. You all came here voluntarily. We all came here willingly. So when the consequences come, well, we have to endure those consequences willingly. No one forced us to sign up for this. You didn't read the terms and conditions, but whose fault is that? Indeed. So, practical advice. Again, this is not saying don't go get married. Parents, don't worry. There are a few young people in this room who are probably expecting to get married, maybe in this year, later on, I don't know. If that is the case, then I'm not saying don't. All I'm saying is, if you want to be happy, parents, don't you want your children to be happy? Are you happy with the fact that your son or your daughter may go and commit suicide if his or her partner, dumps him or her? Are you happy to accept that? Are you prepared to accept that? If you are not prepared to accept that, then you have to prepare them. Because if you don't prepare, then you're going to fail. So prepare them. Show them in advance. Help them understand that happiness is not a function of the outside world. If happiness is X and the outside world is Y, there is no relationship between X and Y. None. You can't plot it on a graph. You seriously can't, because X and Y are not interconnected. There's no relationship between them. But the moment you plug in avidya, the moment you plug in ignorance, now you just built a bridge. You've just built a bridge between the two shores. There was never a connection between the shore on the left and the shore on the right. There was no connection until you built the bridge. Now, for as long as that bridge exists, what happens on the left-hand side has an impact on what happens on the right-hand side. So show them that. Help them understand. Only last week we did another sermon to a lot of young children in Canada. They do a monthly session where there's lots of young children. I think they get together at someone's home, then switch on Skype, and then if this is tough, then you can imagine how tough that is. With the lag and trying to, I use a lot of body language in my sermons, and to be able to express myself and not being able to see if they're nodding this way or that way, it's incredibly challenging. But, lots of young children there, and they tell me that they listen to these sermons as well, and so particularly for young children, who perhaps are now distant from our values, our culture that we have in this country. If parents don't make an effort to instill those values, instill our culture into their young minds, then beware. Beware. If you don't show them, if you don't help them understand that your happiness dua, your happiness puta, is not a function of the outside world, they're going to continue to think that that is the case. And they're going to expect happiness from the outside world. Someone dumps you, you lose your mind, that's the worst that could happen to that person. Go and jump in front of a train. But what if you don't lose your mind, but now you decide to take revenge? Now? Of the two, which one's more serious, do you think? Guy dumps a girl, she decides to go and commit suicide. One. Guy dumps a girl, she decides to take revenge. As a parent, which of these would you prefer? If you only had one of these two options, which would you prefer? If you're thinking, no, I would not want my child to lose his mind, do anything else with the other one. That's okay. My son, my child, should not go insane, should maintain sanity. Well, if it's revenge that he's going to be seeking next, if it's stealing, if it's lying, if it's slander, if it's killing that he's prepared to do next, now the consequences. Why do you think he or she had to suffer a heartache? Why do you think he or she had to suffer a breakup? Because of a previous misdeed, right? So now it's time to reap what you have sowed. Previously sowed, now you reap. What if you sow again? Now it's double trouble. So really, as a parent, you should wish for your child to go insane if the other alternative is he or she seeking revenge. Right? Tell me if I've got it wrong. Because when the consequences come for the misdeed that you do, now? But do you see, if these are the two options, ladies and gentlemen, how this becomes a dilemma? How you get stuck? These are the riddles that life throws at us. The dilemmas that life throws at you. And then you become helpless. Because now you're trying to treat the symptoms. You didn't treat the problem. You didn't treat the problem when you could. Now you're trying to treat symptoms. It's too late now. This is why it's so important to treat the problem before the symptoms start to show up. I think some sermons ago I invited parents openly. I said, parents, create a safe environment for your children to come and open up to you. If they're addicted to pornography, parents, create an environment where they can come and speak up to you and say, Mom, Dad, I can't control myself. Every time I go and sit in front of the computer, the first thing that comes to mind is XXX. Help me. Because if you don't, parents, as responsible adults, create that environment for your children, what do you think they're going to do? Who do you think they're going to speak to? Because when that vexation arises in their minds, they're going to have to go and speak to somebody. They'll want to go and release that pain, that agitation that they have with somebody. Chances are they're going to go and release that agitation that they have with someone who's also a consumer. And they're expecting supplies from your child. It could be another kid in the classroom who's also addicted. Now again, double trouble. Did I not tell you about the time when one of our monks, when he came to ordain with us, he'd only gone to grade 6 at school. And he tells me the first time that he got to see porn, which was in his classroom. A classmate had brought a video on a phone to share with his classmates. And the most sickening thing was that the video was of the child's parents. The video was of the child's parents. He was showing this video to his classmates. Ma Changsi, would you like me to Bluetooth it to you? Parents, until your children seek refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha, until that day comes, they are destitute. This is why they rely on you. When I was growing up, I didn't have that luxury. Part of my life, I didn't spend with my parents. But the most part, I did. And I remember vividly the experiences I had on both times. But what was common between both experiences was that none of them that I grew up with had any understanding of the Dhamma. I was not as fortunate as this young son was at his age. I was not that fortunate. I was not as fortunate as this young man was at his age. Because I didn't have a mother or a father that I could go and speak to and get proper advice from. Because all the advice I got from them, through no fault of theirs, because they didn't understand the Dhamma, they didn't know the Dhamma. So they did the best that they could. They said, don't do it. That's all they said. But that was only treating the symptom, not the disease. Because they didn't know how to treat the disease. But you do. Parents, you do. How fortunate do you think this young boy is? Unimaginably. Do you have a mother like this? Incredibly fortunate. From a very young age to be growing up with that noble association, with that moral association, constantly being fed with nothing other than the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha and the values. Constantly being able to taught about how to treat the problem and not just address the symptoms of the problem. That is what we need. So particularly to parents who listen to these sermons, I make this invitation again. Create that environment. Particularly if you live abroad. Because in those countries, you know, they children there are more connected with technology than they are with their mother and their father. Who's your best friend? My phone. I remember when I was his age, who's your best friend? The answer was my mother. But as youngsters these days, who's your best friend? My iPhone. My PS4. My laptop. The internet. Well, that's who you spend the most time with, so no kidding. So you have a responsibility. Create that environment where your children can come and share with you, can speak up with you. And then don't give them the stick treatment when they come and open up with you. There may be appropriate times to do that, but I'm saying when they come and talk to you about the fires of desire, aversion and delusion that appear, that come up in their minds, that's not the time to give them the stick treatment. That's the time to have a proper conversation. Putta, I know why you feel this way. This is why. And there's a way to address that problem. How many young kids today have a picture of the great elders Sariputta, Moggallana, Mahakashyapa in their bedrooms? How many? Well, you know the answer. But what about Spider-Man? And Batman? And Superman? Virtually everyone. Because that's who have become their heroes. Superman's my hero. Batman's my hero. Spider-Man's my hero. Hulk's my hero. Ben 10's my hero. You've made a hero of someone who suffers from the fires of desire, aversion and delusion. Let me put it this way, right? So Superman's a good guy, right? He's a decent guy. So what does Superman do when there's injustice? He goes and sorts the world out, right? He goes and fixes the problem. How does he fix the problem? By preaching the Dhamma, right? So Clark Kent puts his cape on, and then he flies from his bedroom, and then goes to the villain and says, "Sit down. I have some words of advice to give you. You know, you're feeling pretty angry right now, right? That's because of attachment. It's avidya and tanha, that's the problem." That's how Superman handles the problem, right? No? Oh. How does he deal with the problem? He gives them a good whacking, right? Yes. So, if I hit somebody, is that a meritorious deed or an unmeritorious deed? If I hit somebody, I will, hang on, I'm a monk. surely I should be excused. Am I? Am I? No. Oh, okay. So if I hit somebody, then that's an unmeritorious deed. Beg your pardon, sir? How do you mean? Intention, yes. So intention being, I want to show them who's boss. Intention being, I don't like them. So if I'm to hit somebody with no anger in my mind, then at least I should be at the level of an anagami. Because it's at that point that one of the fetters, patiga, is removed from their sentiments once and for all, never to come back. Okay? So up until that point, if you hit somebody and there's anger, I mean, there's going to be anger. I'm not going to say always, because again, it is absolutely right intention. But if anger creeps in because you feel injustice is happening, I don't like that, the world's not to my liking, isn't that why Superman flies out of his bedroom? Is it because the world's to his liking, or is it because the world's not to his liking? It's not to his liking. What about Batman? When the Joker does stuff that Batman doesn't like, now he goes to sort him out. Because the world's now not to my liking. I don't like injustice, so I have to sort it out. So how does Batman, he flies over and then sits down with the Joker? Joker said, that's not joke, right? And then he preaches a sermon that helps him to extinguish the fires of desire, aversion and delusion, right? No, that's not how it happens. He hits him, hurts him, physically. Now, is that meritorious or unmeritorious? Any doubts? That's unmeritorious. So for a kid to be watching an unmeritorious deed and be really excited about that, I'm talking about something that I used to do. I'm watching Superman go and hit the bad guy, and I'm feeling really pretty excited about that. When Superman whacks his arm out, I'm doing the same behind the TV. Sitting and sat in front of the TV. I'm going, yeah, give him a shot. That's it. Give him another one. One for me as well. Now, if rejoicing in a meritorious deed is also meritorious, what about rejoicing in an unmeritorious deed? Absolutely. Now you're happy that someone is being hit. You're feeling joyful. You're feeling happy. You're glad that the bad guy, according to whom? According to the bad guy? No, according to you. According to you, Superman's the good guy, the other guy, the villain's the bad guy. That's why you call him the villain and the Superman the good guy. So now you're happy that the villain's being hit. And now you're rejoicing in that unmeritorious deed. So every time you're rejoicing in that unmeritorious deed, what are you acquiring? Merit or demerit? Demerit. Do you see the danger? You're not even hitting somebody. You're just sat in front of a TV. And the truth of the matter is, on the scene, that man's not hitting anybody. Superman's not really hitting anybody. He's just in front of a green screen. He's just whacking his arms in the air. No one's really being hurt. But what about you watching TV? Batman doesn't feel a modicum of anger. He's quite happy. And quite possibly at the end of the scene, when the director goes cut, both the good guy and the bad guy, they go for a drink at the pub. That was a good scene, mate, don't you think so? Yeah, you know, I really like the way you whacked your arm at me. That was super cool. The good guy and the bad guy, they're just having a drink at the pub. But what about you and I, watching TV? Watching that movie, watching that scene? so much anger in our hearts. Isn't anger an unmeritorious deed? So now, parents, you sit your child in front of the TV. Puta, come, let me show you. It's time, it's screen time. Let's watch some TV. What would you like to watch? I like to watch Batman. Yeah, sure, it's Batman. Watch it. By the way, I'm not saying don't watch Batman. I don't want Batman knocking on my door. I'm not saying don't watch Superman. I'm not saying watch or don't watch anything. All I'm saying is I'm trying to help you figure out for yourself what you ought to be doing. Because you sit your child in front of that TV, parents. If your child is not intelligent enough to realize that this is all fake. This is just acting. This is just entertainment. There's really no violence going on behind the scene. If your child's not intelligent enough to figure that out, then your child's going to start to feel that anger inside his heart. Now, you paid for that movie, right? Whether it's on Netflix or Hulu, or you downloaded it, got the video, or whatever. Even if you went to the cinema, you paid to be there. If your child is reminded of that scene, of that anger at the time of his death, now what have you just paid for? To give him a one-way ticket. Where to? Well, you know. Do you realize the danger? That's only half of it. What about computer games? I'm not saying play them or don't play them. That's not for me to say, parents, that's for you to decide. A lot of computer games these days, from what I hear, from what I know, and from what our young novice monks come and tell me. You know, they tell me a lot of computer games nowadays is violence. Some of the names are in Grand Theft Auto. Apparently what you have to do is go and beat the hell out of somebody. I've got nothing against GTA. That's cool, GTA, apparently it's called. I've got nothing against that, okay? So please don't come knocking on my door for the producers of that game. All I'm saying is think about what you're doing to your children. When I was growing up, I didn't have video games to play with. I went and played with my friends. We rode a bike. Played in the sand. Played tic-tac-toe. That's what I played. Snake and ladders. That's what I played. But the world's pretty advanced now. You don't realize the dangers of these parents. You know, your child not knowing what's going on behind the scenes. You know, every time they hit, you know, every time, you know, if they're in control of one of the figures in the game, one of the actors in the game, and now it's your time to pick up the gun and shoot at the bad guy. Every time you press that button, you're pulling the trigger. Fair enough, it's not killing anybody. So there's no panatipata happening. Fair enough. But what about anger? Are there feelings of kindness and compassion that you have towards the enemy when you pull that trigger? Or do you in the back of your heads go, die, 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 die? Every time you're pulling that trigger, the fire of anger, the fire of aversion, the flames burning inside your heart. Who bought them the game? You know the answer. Are you okay with the fact that if that is the thought that comes into your child's mind at the point of death, that has the potential to take them into the four great hells? Parents, are you okay with that? Seriously? And you call yourself parents? I'm not addressing any of you, by the way, okay? This is just a sermon. I'm speaking generally for everybody to think. Even if it's a car game, I used to love Need for Speed. In the car game, there was one event where what you had to do was crash into other people so that you could become first. You just crash into other people, other people's cars. Now, I remember myself playing that game. I didn't have thoughts of kindness or compassion. Oh, it's okay, you go, I'll come later. No, it was, I want to be first. And I don't care if I have to crash you to get first, to be first. Samma sankappa or miccha sankappa? What is samma sankappa? Nekkamma sankappa, avihinsa sankappa, avyapada sankappa. What is miccha sankappa? Kama sankappa, vyapada sankappa, vihinsa sankappa. Vyapada is anger. Vihinsa? Malevolence. Wanting to cause harm, damage to the other person, to the other thing, whatever. Person or thing. Doesn't matter. If samma sankappa leads you to nibbana, what does miccha sankappa lead you to? See? You didn't think about that, did you? I speak to the parents who are listening to these sermons online as well. Because this is why I started with this sermon. You know, you are privileged. You're well-to-do. You have enough money and more to buy your kids every game that they ask for. I remember how many times I had to go and plead in front of my father to get myself a computer. How many exams I had to sit and become first in class, how many times before he got me a Windows 95 computer. That was my first machine. And all I could do on that was draw on paint. And how much I had to plead in front of him to get myself a bike. And still he didn't get me one. But nowadays, all they have to do is ask, right? So parents, please, think about it. You don't realize how much damage you're doing to your children. You don't realize it's life and death you're messing with here. You don't realize it's hell and heaven you're messing with here. So if you don't help them understand this doctrine, if you don't help them realize that with every malevolent thought that comes into their minds, every thought of ill will, every thought of anger, hate that comes into their minds, they're causing themselves harm and damage. If you don't teach them that, then I think it's best you keep that world away from them. You keep them away from that world. Either teach them so that they're able to understand, they're wise enough, they're intelligent enough to realize this is just a game. Even, you know, it's not enough to understand it's just a game. You should be able to pull the trigger not feeling any anger towards your enemy. I mean, I don't know how you're going to be able to do that. So you should be able to pull the trigger going, may the Noble Triple Gem bless you. May the Noble Triple Gem bless you. May the Noble Triple Gem bless you. So if your child is able to do that, then it's okay. But if your child is not able to do that, then I think it's best keep those two apart. Because you don't realize how much damage you're doing to them. I know it's not easy for you to now find friends that your children can go and play with in the playground, because you know nobody trusts anybody these days. Right? There's pedophiles everywhere. So nobody trusts anybody. Why doesn't anybody trust anybody anymore? What is missing? What's the missing piece of the puzzle? Dhamma. Absolutely. That's what's missing. Vishwasa parama jnati. Remember? Jnati is what? Know your relation. That's the conventional meaning. Jnati jnane is to know knowledge of what? The Dhamma. Only someone who has the gift of Dhamma, only for someone in whom the Dhamma has been instilled, can you trust. Can you really trust anyone who's not even a Sotapanna? Really think about it? Because a Sotapanna is someone, if a Pratakjana, a mundane person is someone who is willing at any cost to get from you what it is that they're looking for, how can you trust that person? Parents, think about it. If you have to leave your child at a friend's place overnight because you have to go somewhere for something, don't you think twice after you've read all the things on in the papers, watched news, knowing that there are, you know, people who behave like animals out in the world? Don't you think twice before you do it? Why? Because you don't know what might happen to that child overnight. Lots of people have come to me and shared their experiences. You don't realize. Like I said, I thought I knew about the world when I was a layperson. Only after I ordained did I really get to understand the world through all the experiences that everyone comes and shares with me. How parents come and tell me, Swami Nuhansa, this person who was my brother, I left my child with him. The following day, I had to find out my brother. Because all it takes is wrong view. Drishtiya. All it takes is that idea, is that notion, that sentiment. That's all it takes for someone who suffers from ignorance, 100% ignorance. Because at least when you become a Sotapanna, let's say ignorance drops to 75%. That extra 25% is what you need, is the amount of ignorance that you need to do something that takes you to the four great hells. When that ignorance has been removed, now you're left with the 75. That 75 is not enough for anybody to do anything that's going to take them to the four great hells. This is why a Sotapanna does not like, has no interest in doing an unmeritorious deed, in trying to acquire what they desire by hurting somebody else, by causing harm and damage to somebody else. They're not interested in doing that. They're not happy. They don't like to do that. Because they have realized the anicca, dukkha, anatta nature of the world at least by that much. So how can you trust someone who's not a noble person? Seriously, how can you? If you're saying your child is your most prized possession, you tell me, how can you leave your children with anybody, not knowing if they're a Sotapanna or not? I'll ask you openly. You don't have to answer. How many of you as young children might have had similar experiences? You know the answer. As a young boy or a young girl, having left with a stranger, having left with someone who to your family was well known, the parents came back to find out that you were abused. That was then. Now it's 25, 30, 40 years on. Every year that passes by, the Dhamma continues to rescind. This is why, parents, I again urge you, make it a point to give the gift of Dhamma to your children. It may be difficult, perhaps language can be a barrier, but don't stop at that. If you have to take your child to another country with the promise of a beautiful, wonderful life, then language doesn't become a barrier. If your child has to get to the best school that you want to get the child into, and you have to learn an extra language to get there, well, then language never became a barrier. Now you're prepared to teach your child that language. So why is it then to give the gift of Dhamma you have to think twice. Again, general advice, not particularly to you, those of you here, but you know, there'll be, you'll have relations who live in other countries, perhaps those who might have left the motherland at a very young age, and now they've been settled in those countries, and now they have no intention of returning. Perhaps, you know, their children, grandchildren, they're all there now. Remind them of the dangers that lurks in the darkness. The darkness of what? Ignorance. The darkness of ignorance. If you are listening to these sermons, parents, find books, find sermons, and help your children to understand, help your children to learn about the great elders, the Arahatun Mahanses that used to live in the past, our ancestors. For young girls, what about the Arahant nuns that used to live? Not so long ago, when you consider how long you've come through in samsara, is only 2.5 centuries ago. We are still fortunate enough to find scriptures and texts that have a lot of detail about these Arahants. And there are some great authors who have gone to great extents to produce these books. I think there's one, Mr. Gayan Chanukka Vidhanapatirana, whose books I often take time to read, because he's gone through great effort, great lengths to find out information about the Arahants who used to live in the past, and he's compiled them into books. I think pretty much all of the 80 great elders he's compiled into books. So go and find those books. They're written in the Sinhala language, so if your children don't understand, they can't read Sinhala, then parents, what do you think your duty is? Find them a new hero. For now it may be Superman. For now it may be Batman. It's time to find them a new hero. The only reason that they don't find a hero in Sariputta, the great elder, Moggallana, the great elder, Rahula, the great elder, Ananda, the great elder, is because they don't know them yet. They don't know them yet. That's why. It is one of my dreams to try and translate those books at least, or at least to take what I have learned from those books and write them in English for the benefit of a lot of young children. I don't know how long it's going to take. It's a dream. I don't know if it'll ever come true. But it's a dream. Just in the hope that our young children will find a new hero in their lives. Because at the end of every sermon, we wish may this blessed land be able to witness many hundreds and thousands of Arahants in our very own, in our lives itself. But where do you think they're going to come from? The moon? No, your children. You and your children. An Arahant has to be born within them. It's these young minds, these little minds that have to be transformed into that of an Arahant. That can only happen by understanding who an Arahant is. And then instilling those values within them. But to instill those values, you need to go and find out, you need to go and read about them. And even there are monks who have done lots of sermons, recorded sermons about Arahatan Vahanses. I think there's an entire series by Venerable Kiribat Guru Jnanananda Thero. He's gone through a lot of effort to find out details from the Tripitaka and other books to give the stories of Arahants in a way that we can understand. Again, they're in Sinhala, as far as I know. But as responsible parents, you have a duty to listen to them and translate them into English, if your children have trouble understanding this language. So it's all out there. Look at what a great service he renders, both lay and clergy. We all have weaknesses, but we should be capable of spotting the great qualities of other people and then bringing them out making them shine. That's what we ought to do, because that is the way of the Buddha Shasana. Not to go looking for dung. Because what happens if you go looking for dung all your life? You become a dung beetle. That's not what we are here to do. Despite people's weaknesses, there's always gems to be found. Find them. Help your children listen to them, read them, and then help them find a new hero. Each of our young monks at the monastery has a hero. You go and ask them, who's your hero? They're going to name one of the Arahatan Vanses. One's going to say, Pindola Bharadwaja, Ananda Maharatan Vanse, Sariputta Maharatan Vanse, Moggallana Maharatan Vanse, Kashyap Maharatan Vanse, Bhaddiya Maharatan Vanse. They all have a hero. It is the hero now that they exemplify. Remember when you were young and your hero was Superman? What did you do at home? After watching a Superman movie, you'd get yourself a cape from somewhere, perhaps an old sari that your mother doesn't wear anymore, that goes around your neck, and now you run around the house with the cape, right? Kicking everything in your way. Jumping up on the balcony and doing all sorts of mischief. Because you wanted to be like them. Remember how you walked in the shoes of your fathers when you were younger? Your feet didn't fit, but you tried, because you found a hero. Every kid wants a hero to live by. So give them a good hero to live by. Tell me, someone calls you a dog. Oh, someone calls you a eunuch. Do you know what a eunuch is? A person who is sexless. If I use a singular word, you'll know it, but I don't think I'll be allowed to say that. Starts with poyan. Po. I'm not going to say anymore. Someone calls you a eunuch. If someone calls you that word, and you're a man, tell me, does it not take a real man to come to your senses and go, no, I don't care what you say, I'm not going to say anything in return. I'm not going to fight back. I'm going to be patient. You can say whatever you like, I'm not going to hit you back. I'm not going to say anything to you to hurt your feelings. I'm not going to use any harsh words to you, despite the fact that you've used harsh words to insult me. Is it not a great man who's capable of doing that? Yes or no? Yes. So it takes a great man with great courage, great strength of character, to stand up and go, no, I will not. No matter what you say, despite how many times you're going to say it, I'm not going to say anything back to you. What if you say the same thing back in return? Or what if you pick up something and go and hit the other guy because he just called you a eunuch? Aren't you just proving the fact? He calls you a eunuch and you're going to say, yeah, I'm going to prove to you that I am one. Do you get my point? Because it really takes a great man of strength and character and courage to stand up and go, no, I'm not going to say a word to you. But in picking up a weapon, in saying something in return, in retaliating to that, you're proving the fact that you are one. Because it takes a great man to not say anything. But a eunuch can say it. You called me that, I'm going to call it to you twice. I'm going to say something even bad, even worse, even more hurtful. Practical advice. Apply it into our lives. Because this is practical Nibbana. The rest is theory. This is practical Nibbana. If you've been coming along to Guru Swami Nuhansa's sermons, you know how he delivers his sermons. The first part he says, try and stay up. The second part, it's okay to sleep. Because the rest is going to be theory. But this is practical stuff. That's my favorite stuff as well. Because it's the practice, you know, I need something practical. Because the theory is only 20%, 80% is practical. So that was the practical stuff. Let's revisit what we discussed last week. We talked about the dependent origination process. And the reason I brought up the dependent origination process was to primarily help you all to understand that when the Buddha says the reason that beings go through in samsara is because they are unable to penetrate the veil of pleasure. You see pleasure? Excuse me. You see pleasure, you experience pleasure, and now you attach yourself to pleasure. You don't see what lies behind the pleasure. For as long as you're ignorant, for as long as you're blind to what lies behind that curtain, you're going to go through in samsara. Right? Having said that, the Buddha also says, the reason that beings go through in samsara is because of their ignorance of the dependent origination process. Again, it's a process. It's a process because a process has an input and a process has an output. So what's the input, what's the output of this process? What is the input of this process? Sir? No. Avidya is a condition. It's a condition that has to be true for this process to run. You see? That's also one of the parts of the process. But the input to the process are the thoughts that come into the mind. The thought objects. Arammana. Because it's once a thought comes into this process, going through the filters of ignorance and attachment, out comes what? Out comes what? Dukkha. Suffering. Yes. This is what this process produces, nothing else. In an ice cream factory, you have a process which produces what? Ice cream. In a shirt factory, you have a process that produces what? Shirts. In a factory that has the board Paticca Samuppada, what can you expect to buy at the shop? Dukkha. Suffering. That's what they sell in this shop. Yes, there is Avyakruta Paticca Samuppada and all that, but we are talking about the problem, where the problem lies. Because that's what we are trying to tackle with. So in this process, the input is the Arammana, the thought object that comes into the mind, and the output is suffering. So now that's a problem. Because if this process is continuously running in our mind, then we know for a fact that every time this process runs, out comes suffering. Every time, suffering, suffering, suffering and more suffering. So wouldn't you like to bring this process to a stop? Bring it to a halt? Because for as long as this process is running, if the only thing that this process is able to produce is suffering, then, well, we have to bring this process to an end. And also, fortunately, it's a process. Because every process can be stopped. If you wanted to. A process can be stopped if you wanted to. If you want to. So this process produces suffering and you can stop it if you choose to. If you don't choose to, well, you can keep it running. But it's going to produce nothing other than suffering. Nothing else is going to come out of this process. So, we started the detail of the dependent origination process by speaking about the tail end, if you remember from last week. Because this is where beings experience the suffering. This is where the problem becomes real. Because when there's jati, there's jara, marana, shoka, parideva, dukkha, domanasa, right? So death, disease, decay, lamentation, sorrow, despair, destitution, frustration, all these types of suffering that follows after jati, existence, so coming into being. After that point forward, this is all the suffering that we experience. It's the stuff that we experience that is a problem that we all feel. Now, let me put it this way. to give you a really simple example, because I understand there are various, you know, people of all ages here, so I want everybody to be able to take something away from this. The first part was, I suppose, the easy part, but the more important part. But this part is going to be a little bit heavy, but I'm going to keep it simple, even for this young child here to be able to understand. As much as I possibly can. I'm not going to promise it, but I'll try. You're only going to know that something's wrong when you start to feel it. Let's say you've eaten something that you shouldn't have. You're going to know that you shouldn't have eaten it when you start to feel a tummy ache. Now you know, I shouldn't have eaten that. But now it's too late, because you've eaten it. It's too late then. So this is when you start to feel it. Because feeling unhappiness, feeling suffering, we all can do quite well. We're all capable of, right? So when you experience death, disease, decay, old age, lamentation, frustration, weeping, sorrow, all that stuff, now it's time to do something about it. Just like the reason you decided to go to see the doctor was bigger, because you started to feel the symptoms. You started to feel the pain, the ache, the fever. These are all things that we feel, right? We experience. That's when we decided to go to see the doctor, because you didn't know you had a disease until the symptoms started to appear. So in the dependent origination process, the symptoms are going to start to appear when disease, decay, death, old age, suffering, lament, these are all symptoms. What do most people try to cure? Symptoms. So when there's disease, people go to the hospital to get medicine so that they can cure the disease. Not cure the problem, cure the disease. When you're feeling hungry, people cook a meal, eat. Does that stop you from feeling hungry again? No, you're going to feel hungry again. In about 6 hours' time, you're going to feel hungry again. So you're not treating the root, you're just treating the symptoms. This is what most people do, and this is what science is there for. In fact, you know, the reason that a lot of young children these days have made their best friend out of their phones, their computers, and so on and so forth is because parents are looking for free time. Parents are looking for spare time. And when parents have things that they enjoy doing, like going out clubbing or pubbing or, you know, going and seeing their friends or just putting their feet up and watching TV or reading the newspaper, now you just need to find a way to keep your kids busy. So, easiest thing to do, here's a phone. Let's get you on the internet. Again, you're treating the symptoms, right? Even the parents are treating the symptoms. But who's suffering ultimately? The child's suffering. See? And you said, I'm selfless. I'm prepared to give anything for my child. But when you're beginning to suffer from the symptoms of the dependent origination process, when you're beginning to suffer frustration, anger, resentment, loneliness, all this, when you're beginning to suffer from that, frustration, right? Now, you want to treat the symptoms. You want time not with your kid. You want time with your TV. You want time with your loved one, not with your kid. You want to go out clubbing. You want to go out pubbing. Now, the easiest thing to do is treat the symptom. Not find out why you feel this way and treat that. Why do you feel like you need to go out? Why is home not good enough? You want variety. So you see, you don't stop to find out why is it that I want variety. You're not treating the problem, you're treating the symptom. You're treating the symptom, who's going to suffer? The kid's going to suffer. So this is what most people try to cure, the symptom. So what happens when we try to cure the symptom? Because this being is someone within whom the condition of ignorance prevails. Through ignorance, a decision is made. Well, I remember that I used to suffer pleasure. I used to enjoy pleasure just a moment ago. Because what has just come to death, disease and decay? What's just gone to death, disease and decay? The death of what are we speaking here? pleasure. Because it's the self that the dependent origination process continues to produce. Yes, I said it was dukkha a moment ago. Well, that implies then dukkha and the self are one and the same. Because we are not speaking about the thing that we can experience. We are taking, you know, the truth is one, what we experience is another. The truth is one, what we feel can possibly be something else. Does that make sense? No, the looks on your faces don't tell me so. So let me, I'll just to help you better understand the point. Let's say you're walking along the road and you've got some slippers on. You've got some slippers on, you're walking along the road, but every time you put your foot on the ground, you're just looking straight up front, you're not looking at the road. Every time you put your foot on the ground, you can feel something pricking your foot. Okay, so this is what you experience. There's a pain, there's a prick that you feel every time you put your foot on the ground. Now, when you feel this prick, when you feel this pain on your foot, you can come to the conclusion that there's something on the road that continues to prick my foot every time I put my foot on the ground. So there's something wrong with the road. But the truth is, there's nothing on the road. Even before you set forth on this journey, there was a thorn that had gone through your slipper. So there's nothing wrong with the road. There's a thorn on the slipper that you put on, that you slid onto your feet. If you're going to continue to think that is something wrong with the road, then you're going to continue to look for another road to walk on, where you're not going to feel the prick. This road's no good because every time I put my foot on the ground, I feel pricking. I feel a prick. So I'm going to try and find another road to walk along. Then you try another road, the same problem, and another road, the same problem, until you stop, remove your slipper, and see, oh, there's a thorn that's got caught in the slipper. Remove, pull out the thorn, now put your slipper back on, and the prick's gone, right? So that's what I'm saying. What you experience, what you feel, is one, but the truth may potentially be something else, can be different. And we have to be careful to be able to pick the right problem. So, ignorance gives us this impression that there was pleasure beforehand. It was the pleasure that came to disease, that went to decay, that went to death. And because I experienced pleasure a moment ago, surely I should be able to produce pleasure once again. Remember, this is pleasure world. This is Natasha. This is the self. All of it, it's all the same. Use these terms interchangeably. Self, baby Natasha, pleasure world, all of this is the same. When it was there, it was good. But it came to an end. When it came to an end, that was not happy, that was painful. So, if there was pleasure beforehand, now it's pain, well surely I should be able to build the pleasure up again. That's the decision that ignorance gives us. So with that decision, now you continue to move forward. Avidya paccaya sankhara. Sankhara gives you the blueprint. This is what pleasure should be like. This is what baby Natasha is like. This is what me is like. Let's go build it. And then remember, if you remember from last week, I said there was an executive board that signs off on the plan, and then there's a project manager who gets involved in the delivery of that production. So like there's a process manager. Remember the dependent origination process, there's a process manager who keeps an eye on the process to make sure this all works like clockwork. And that fellow is Vijnana. So Vijnana now steps in, having received the blueprint, and now it's time to execute. Now, Vijnana, in order to create this blueprint, it goes back into memory banks. So I'm going over stuff that we spoke of last week, so I'm not going to spend too much time talking about on each of the points, okay? Goes into the memory banks, and based on the memory from last time, self was something to do with the outside world.
Why? Remember, this is an ignorant mind that's making this decision. What is an ignorant mind? What does an ignorant mind tells you right now? It's the rain that brings you unhappiness, right? If there was no rain, then we'd all be happy. So the problem is with the rain, right? This is what an ignorant mind tells us. What if the lights all went off? What if there was a power cut? Now, the problems with the outside world again. This is what ignorance tells us. So remember, this dependent origination process is running on the condition where ignorance equals true, not ignorance equals false. Ignorance equals true in this process. So where ignorance equals true, the conclusion is, last time round when I built baby Natasha up, when I built the self up, when I built pleasure land up, it was by using sights and sounds and smells and tastes and touch from the outside world. So if it was from the outside world, using materials from the outside world that I built pleasure last time, well, how do you think we're going to do it this time? It's the same. So once again, I'm going to have to go and bring sights and sounds and smells and tastes and touch from the outside world. This is where it goes ahead and it employs 5 employees: the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, and the body. These 5 senses, well, 6 if you include the mind, these 6 senses are now put into action. Put into action not for anything else, but to produce the self. This is self-procreation. To produce the self, now these 6 senses have been employed and now they get to work. This is the point where indriya or a faculty becomes an institute and indriya becomes an ayatana, ayasthana. This is the point where a faculty becomes an institute. The eye faculty becomes the eye institute. I use the word institute because it's where something is produced. What is being produced here? What are we trying to produce? Pleasure. Another word? Self. Another word? Baby Natasha. Another word? Sandcastle. Right? Examples from previous sermons that we've used. This is what we're trying to produce. So these 6 workers are now getting into action, and what they can do, what can the eye do? Is the eye capable of bringing in sounds? No, all the eye is capable of is being open and letting light come through. Can the eye go and bring light? No, all the eye can do is remain open and allow light through. The eye can't go and bring light. So letting light through is a karma or a vipaka? Karma vipaka. That's a vipaka. Letting it through is a vipaka. But that's what the eye does. That's what the faculty does. But now it's an institute. With an institute, it's not enough to let any old light come through. Now there are particular types of sights that we want to see. Particular types of sounds that I'm interested in listening to. Particular types of tastes that I'm interested in. Because this is how pleasure was created last time round. So if that worked last time round, then sure it's going to work this time round. So now what the eye does is it goes into the world looking for lovely sights. It's like the flower. Is there ever such a thing as a lovely flower in the outside world? You tell me. Are there pretty flowers in the outside world? Pretty flowers? Ugly flowers? Are there pretty girls in the outside world? Sure? So why do you think you're one then? Are there handsome gentlemen in the outside world? Well, sir, why do you think you're one then? That does not exist in the outside world. Because beauty lies in the eye of the beholder. Not in me, it lies in the eyes of the beholder.
Because it's the beholder that decides whether you're pretty or ugly. See, even you can't even decide whether you're pretty or ugly. Even you can't make that call. Can you see, right? Think about it for a moment. All the trouble that you go through, makeup, hair extensions, pedicures, manicures, facials, all that stuff that you go through. Nobody else goes through that for you on your behalf. You go through that, and even then, you don't get to decide whether you're ugly or pretty. Oh, it makes me laugh. Remember, I used to go to the gym every other day. I've shared these stories with you, haven't I? I used to go to the gym and push weights, go on the run on the treadmill. I used to do all that. So I had to go and spend an hour every other day at the gym, and then half an hour to get there, half an hour to get back. That's 2 whole hours in the day, because I wanted myself a six-pack. That's why I went to the gym. More so than health reasons, I wanted to look good. Despite all the trouble that I went through and having paid for a gym subscription, I still don't get to decide whether I look good or not. That's not fair, is it, really? That's so unfair, don't you think so? I go through all this trouble and even I don't get to decide whether I look pretty or ugly. You take a lot of trouble to bake a cake. You want to give it to your loved one, your husband, your boyfriend, your mother, your father, whoever. You go through a lot of trouble. Many hours of finding the ingredients, going shopping, putting these ingredients together, reading the cookery book, making it, baking it, doing all that stuff. And still, you can't decide. You don't get to decide whether it tastes good or not. Fair or unfair? Unfair. Well, then why do you go through it? Because beauty lies in the eye of the beholder. You don't get to decide that. Ladies, you can put all the hair extensions you like. You can put all the perfume, you can wear all the perfume, you can put all the powder or the talcum or whatever you like. You can spend many hundreds and thousands of rupees or pounds or dollars or whatever at the saloon. But you don't get to decide whether you're pretty or you're ugly. What about all those women that stand up on the stage at the Miss World competition? All the trouble that they've gone through to get themselves dressed up, getting themselves into a bikini, getting themselves into that shape, going through all that trouble, they don't even get to eat a good meal. Do you know that? Because even their diet is strictly controlled by their manager. No, ice cream? No, you're not allowed to have ice cream. Why? Because it's going to put on a belly. And even then, they don't get to decide whether they look pretty or not. Who decides that? The onlooker. Do you see the useless, futile, essenceless nature of this? You go through the pain, you take the trouble, but you don't get to decide. You made the cake. You threw the party. But you don't get to decide whether it was a good party or a bad party. Your invitees decide that. See? And that's because beauty does not exist in the outside world. You can never look at yourself in the mirror and go, you're pretty. Because that's a lie. That's a false impression. You're mistaken. Because ask the next guy you meet on the road. What he's going to say is entirely based on his impression of you, not yours. See how helpless we are, despite all the effort we put into
beautifying ourselves, looking good for the world, looking good for the world, right? And the world decides. Anyway, let's come back. So, the institutes, the Eye Institute went out looking for a beautiful sight, a beautiful sound, and the ear went out looking for pleasurable, I'll use the word pleasurable sounds. The Tongue Institute went out looking for pleasurable tastes. The Body Institute went out looking for pleasurable sensations. So seeking pleasure from the outside world, because last time round that's how I found pleasure. So surely this time round, that's how I'm going to find pleasure. Who gives us that idea? Ignorance. Absolutely. And then, salayatana paccaya passa. This is where contact comes in. But remember, if you remember from last week, it's not just any old passa. We're talking about sampassa. Because this passa runs on in a process where ignorance and attachment are two of the key stakeholders of this process. They are workers on this production line. Ignorance and attachment. They are workers on this production line. For as long as they're going to be in this production line, it's not going to be passa, it's going to be sampassa. Because you're not just prepared to accept any old sight, sound, smell, taste. Now this is something you were looking for. It's like walking around with a magnet. Why do you walk around with a magnet? Because you want to collect what? Iron. Because that's what sticks to a magnet. If you wanted plastic, would you walk around with a magnet? No. If you walked around with a bag and you wanted to collect rubbish, then you could fill a bag with any or whatever comes in front of you, you can pick it up. But if you walk around with a magnet, now you're going to come back with iron. That's what you will have collected. Likewise, this is how these institutes have gone out into the world looking for sight, sound, smell, taste and touch. Now this is why it's sampassa. Now at this point, passapaccaya vedana. Through contact comes sensation. Now last week the question that came up at the end of the sermon was, where do the five aggregates fit in? This is where the five aggregates fit in. Because remember, when it was passa, this is the point of contact. This is the point where the eye has taken in the sight and is leaving an impression on the mind. It's the impression being left on the mind, that's the point of passa. Not the eye picking up light, it's the eye leaving an impression on the mind. That is where rupa comes in. Chakku rupa. Or rupa rupa, you could take it as. Rupa rupa, because it's an impression left on the mind by the eye. So rupa rupa. And then vedana. Now remember, it's passapaccaya vedana, right? But when we say passapaccaya vedana, there are lots of other things that we don't speak of, which also happens at the same time. Rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vijnana, all of this happens at that point. Passapaccaya vedana. Because at the point of passa, that's where, remember, this sight is now looking at an object, the eye is now looking at an object, and that impression has been left on the mind. That is the rupa rupa. According to that rupa rupa, now there has to be vedana, which is recognizing that something has happened. Knowing that something has happened, I have just seen a sight. That's the vedana at that point. Passapaccaya vedana. Then there's sanya, identifying what it is that has just happened. To give it a sanya, this is recognition. You have to go into your memory banks again. Because now remember, we are trying to fit into this model. The eye is looking at the outside world. We've got a model of what it is that we want to look at, and now we are matching these two. This is what's happening. It's like if I said betel leaf. The moment I say betel leaf, there's a picture of a betel leaf in your mind, isn't there? It's not necessarily the betel leaf that I have in my hand. You all have a mental impression, a mental image of a betel leaf. Now when I show you this like this, what you're doing in your mind is comparing this to the betel leaf that you have in your minds.
Because the moment your eye picked up this impression, this picture, this image, this sight, it left a mental impression on your mind. That was the point of passapaccaya vedana. But for that vedana to have arisen, there was a rupa as well. Not this rupa. The rupa that appeared in your mind, that mental impression. Rupa. This is rupa. But rupa, that's in your mind. All clear so far? You can ask questions if any of that doesn't make sense at this point. Sometimes I regret picking up topics like dependent origination. But I also want to help you to be able to understand this at the same time. Because, I mean, I myself have listened to lots of sermons and lectures on dependent origination, but much of them didn't really answer lots of questions that I had in my mind. I wasn't able to see back then how it's dependent origination process is there to help me to penetrate the veil of pleasure. Now that I see the connection, I'm trying to explain this to you, but I'm not sure whether it's too heavy. I'm not sure if you're losing interest. So you should indicate to me if this is worthwhile, or I'm prepared to change topic if that suits. But if you have questions, please feel to ask. Okay? So, remember at this point, there's a mental impression left on the mind. That's the rupa, because you're looking at a sight. Then there was vedana. The mind has picked up that something has happened. Vimagdanuna. Again, sorry to use Sinhala, but I don't know how else to explain that. The mind has picked up that something has happened. Now it has to give it recognition, an ID. It's like you're driving along the road, the policeman stops you. The policeman sees you and now he knows something has happened. Or let's say he's got a speedometer. Or the gun that with which he catches what speed you're going at. Right? Or a speedometer. So he's holding that to your car. He now picks up that something has happened because it sends an alert, an alarm on the speedometer. And now he stops you. Now he's going to have to come and identify you. So he says, "Hey, mister, can you show me your ID card? Can you bring me your national ID?" So this is the point where the mind has to give it identification. It has to identify what has the eye just picked up. Because remember, it's trying to compare with the impression, with the model that it already has. To check if this is what I have, you have to identify what you've just seen. Let me give you a really simple example. Let's say you all know someone called Richard. And I say, can you all please go to the main hall and ask Richard to come here? So if you all know who Richard is, then you all have an image of Richard in your mind, right? Before you set forth? Well, you must, because otherwise how are you going to know when you see Richard? So you'll all have a mental impression of this is what Richard looks like. If you have heard his voice, then you'll know here's what Richard sounds like. So when you go into the main hall and you now scan the room, every object you see, you're scanning. You see a chair. You check, is this Richard? No, this is a chair, it's not Richard. So this can't be who I'm looking for. Move along. Now you see a table. Is this Richard? No. Move along. Now you see a woman. Well, a woman can't be Richard. So this can't be Richard. Move along. This is why sometimes if a lady came up to you and said, you ask her, what's your name? She says, I'm Richard. Doesn't that sound a little bit odd? Why does it sound odd? Here's the answer. Right? Because you don't expect a woman to say her name's Richard. Because when you know a woman, you've created your model. And in that model, and the name of the woman cannot be Richard. It can be Jane. It can be Nancy. But it can't be Richard. Why? Drushti. These are all views that we hold. There can't be a woman called Richard. That's why. But there are times when you, in society, we meet people and you ask them, what's your name? So I remember when I first went to the UK and I met a woman and I asked her, what's your name? She said, Joe. And I thought Joe was the name of a bloke. Said, sorry, madam? Joe's my name. Oh, okay. And there were Sams. Because they shortened names. Samantha becomes Sam. I said, how's your name Sam? You don't look like a Sam to me. Because I had the impression of this is what a Sam looks like in my mind. You know, that at that moment, do you not feel something inside your mind? Is that something's not right? That's that point where you're trying to fit the outside world into your model and it doesn't fit. It's like trying to fit on someone else's shoe. You know, when you're leaving the monastery, if you can't see where you left your shoe, if you're feeling in the darkness, you're probably going to try and slide your foot into somebody else's shoe and go, no, that doesn't fit. You know, that point where you just feel like something's not right. Why do you feel that? Because you have a model, you're trying to fit the outside world into your model and it doesn't fit. So this is what happens. So you're looking for, in the example that we were using, the betel leaf, Richard. You went into the hall looking for Richard. You're looking at a lady and go, no, that can't be Richard. That could have been Richard. Let's say there was a lady called Richard, and I wanted you to bring Richard. I wanted you to ask Richard to come here, and I actually meant the woman, not the man. You went to the main hall looking for a man. You come back and say, no, Richard's not in the main hall. What do you mean he's not? I can see the CCTV camera. She's in the main hall. What do you mean she's in the main hall? Oh, you meant the she, Richard. Yes, the she. Now go and get her. See? How we stereotype? Stereotype is simply that. We have our models. That's what stereotyping is. It's all that. All our models. These are models that we firmly hold on to. Unwilling to change sometimes. So, at that point of passa, contact, now there's the rupa-rupa. Because it's a sight you're looking at. Then there's the vedana, something's happened. Now you've given it identification. Here's what that sanya, here's what that rupa-rupa was. Or if it was a sound you heard, here's what that sound was. You've again gone back into memory banks and pulled out the information from there. So rupa vedana sanya sankara. With every object, there's some kind of action that is associated with it. Some kind of action. If it's an apple, what do you do with an apple? Eat. See, eat is the sankara that is associated with apple. But there could be others as well. Feel, that's also sankara. Smell, that's also sankara. Not the smell of it. I'm talking about the verb, not the noun. Smell. That's the sankara associated with an apple. That's why when you reach out for a mango, you know, when you go shopping for mangoes, how do you find a good mango? Smell. First you look at it, looks good, pick it up, and then smell it. Because when I say mango, smelling the mango is one of the sankara that is associated in your mind with a mango. That's where sankara comes. If I say bike, what's the first thing that comes into mind? Ride. Sankara. Whereas for an arahant, I say bike, he's not necessarily going to think ride. He's going to say, well, okay, bike, what do you want me to do with it? Because there are no preconceived notions that come in. If you ask an arahant to ride a bike, he may ride a bike. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if an arahant would want to ride a bike. But if you asked him to ride a bike, he might ride a bike. But showing a bike, he's not going to immediately, this action, ride, is not going to come into his mind. That comes into our minds. You see bike, ride. Right? You see food, eat. You see apple, smell, taste. All these things. These are all sankhara. You see bed, what do? Sleep. Sankhara. These are all the sankharas that are associated with that. And then vijnana. So vijnana is the totality of all the above. And how you feel about that object. That's vijnana. That's a tough one to try and explain. Because it's the totality. It's like the sum total of all of the above. So if I said, for example, chair, okay? The chair has a sight, right? It has a rupa. This is a chair. Now, if it's a plastic chair, let's say the chair you're sat on right now, if you banged on it, you'd know what it sounds like. But fortunately, you've not bitten into it, so you don't know how it tastes. So, when I say chair, you know how it looks, you know how it sounds, you know how it... What else? Feels. You know how it feels. So these are three things that come with the word chair. It's all a package. This is all upadana. Because the moment I say chair, do not expect a chair to be a certain way. You expect to be able to sit on a chair, don't you? This is why when you sit on a chair, and if the legs go in all directions and you fall to the ground, now you go all... No, what's just happened? That shouldn't have happened. It's a chair. I should be able to sit on it. This way, when you feel out and try and touch a hollow ground, you go, what just happened there? I should be able to touch it. Because these are expectations that you have. See how, to what length we've gone to put, with setting expectations? What length we've gone to setting expectations? You know, simple things like everyday objects, we've set expectations on all of them. If you see rain, then you expect the rain to make you wet, right? If you walk in the rain, then you expect the rain to make you wet. What if one day you walk in the rain and you don't get wet? Something's not right. Don't you feel something's wrong? And a feeling of unease happens in your mind? Why? Expectation. Again, it's expectation. Expectation is really, really subtle. That's why you feel unease. Let's say there's a cup of tea. Someone's just brought you a cup of tea. Okay? And you feel the mug or the... You put your hand out, you feel the mug and it's hot. Now don't you expect the tea to be hot? If you feel the mug is hot, don't you expect the tea to be hot? You've just set yourself an expectation. Now you put the tea to your lips and the tea is cold. How would you feel at that point? Something's not right. Expectation has led you to disappointment. Because at that, you know, it may well be that you like to drink a cold tea. It may well be the case. But at that point, because you felt that the mug was hot, you set an expectation that the tea has to be hot. So despite the fact that you like iced tea, at that point in time, you're expecting a hot tea in the mug. So when you put that tea to your lips, if that tea is cold, sapavedana or dukavedana? Dukvedana. That brings you unpleasurable feeling. That's how it happens. But at the next moment, because you like iced tea, now you have a different expectation. Now, oh, alright, okay, this is iced tea. Next moment you're expecting iced tea. What if it went hot again, the next moment? Again, something's wrong. Because with every moment we set expectations. When you walk into this room, when you sit on this chair, you expect to be able to sit, don't you? When you stand up, do you not expect to be able to stand up on your two feet? The person that sat on that chair each of you, don't, in your minds, don't you think that your feet, your legs are able to support your weight? You all think that, don't you? Are you entirely sure about that? Excuse me. Couldn't something have happened during the course of this sermon whereby the bottom half of your body has gone numb? Couldn't something have happened? Surely. You try to stand up at the end of this sermon and your legs can't bear your weight. Now you fall to the ground. Does that only bring you physical discomfort or does that also bring you mental discomfort? Absolutely. Let's say there's a cushion behind you. So you fall down, no problem. It's not going to hurt you. It's very comfortable. So no physical discomfort, but what about the mental discomfort? Has that gone away? No, why not? Expectation. Expectation. When you try to button a shirt, sometimes do you not get really annoyed? You try to button it like several times and it doesn't go in. Why? Because you see button, you see buttonhole. Your expectation is, yes, I should be able to button it. What about when you try to start your car? Expectation? When you turn the ignition, your expectation is car has to start. So then tell me, when you inhale and pull in air through your nostrils, do you not expect to be able to breathe? What if you weren't? What if you weren't able to? Right now, the next breath, you're expecting to be able to breathe, right? You're all expecting to be able to take the next breath? Yes or no? Yes. What if all of a sudden, when I go like that, I'm able to pull out all the air in this room? The next breath you take, nothing goes into your lungs. How would you feel? Would there be any physical discomfort? Well, at least not for another 10 seconds or so. I mean, can't you hold your breath for a few moments? You're not going to feel physical discomfort immediately. We can all hold our breath for a few moments, at least 4 or 5 seconds, right? So the next moment you try to breathe, if there's no air, that's not going to bring you physical discomfort, at least not for a few seconds. But what about the mental discomfort? The mental pain. What is the root of all mental discomfort and pain? Attachment. Expectation. So don't you see, with every breath you take, you're setting expectations? With every breath you take, you're setting expectations? Do you realize how attached you are? With every breath you take, with every beat of that heart, there's expectations. Expectations galore. Now imagine, with every thought that arises, there are expectations. Because of attachment. Because all mental suffering starts from attachment. That's where the root is. So take away attachment, an arahant, let's say one of us is an arahant. I remove all the air in this room, I create a vacuum in here. In the flash of a second, we've all taken one breath, the next breath, an arahant tries to breathe, there's no air. No physical discomfort, at least for the next few moments. And mental discomfort? None. Okay. No air. Because no attachment, no expectations. This is the level to which we go down when we set expectations. Every thought is based in expectations. And expectation is what leads to disappointment. So, going back again to that dependent origination, this is why I use examples, just to give you a little bit of variety, otherwise, you know, core theory might be a little bit too daunting for some. So I'm helping you to understand this by giving examples. Can we switch on the fans by any chance? So at the moment where there was Passapaccaya Vedana, where there was contact, and dependent on contact, there was Vedana, which was sensation. It was not just sensation that came in at that point. But then why did the Buddha only speak of Passapaccaya Vedana, Vedana Paccaya Tanha? Why did he not speak about the other things? Because it's the Vedana, that sensation which is pleasurable. That's how you experience the pleasure. And it's the experience of the pleasure that you then go on to attach to. Because, imagine this. Imagine there were only four aggregates. There were no five aggregates. There was Rupa, Sanya, Sankara and Vijnana. No Vedana. There wouldn't be a problem. You wouldn't be attached. Because is it not pleasure that we are attached to? How do you feel pleasure? It's because of the Vedana, that mental factor. It's through Vedana that we experience the pleasure. Not pleasure that came from the outside world. Previously there was the pain, the Vedana of having set the expectation, which was an unpleasurable feeling. Because setting an expectation itself is a feeling of uneasiness, discomfort. Because, and that's why we like to relieve ourselves from that feeling. Remember, I often use the example of presents that are wrapped up. Like a friend brings you a gift wrapped up, and what's the next thing you want to do? Unwrap it. You want to unwrap it so you can find out what it is that your friend has brought you. So why does unwrapping presents bring you a good feeling? Expectation. It's not the present. Yes, the present might bring you a good feeling, but that's secondary. Primarily, there's the, I want to know what's inside. There's two things, right? There's, I want to know what the present is. And secondly, it's going to be, is the thing that has just been presented to me, gifted to me, going to be something that I like? Two things. They're not one and the same. So be able to distinguish these two. One is, I want to know. It's like, say you're at home, you hear a knock on the door. Now you don't know who's outside. Firstly, you're suffering because you want to know who's at the door. That could be a debt collector, or it could be your best friend. At this point, it doesn't matter. At this point, you just want to know who's outside. Because of that, you're suffering. You're in a state of vexation. So you walk up to the door, now you open the door, and now you see who it is that's outside. Now you have just been relieved from the first vexation, which was, you wanted to know who was outside. Now you know. Now there's the second problem. I like or don't like the person that's outside. They're not one and the same. Understood? Okay. So, when we have Passapaccaya Vedana, it's that Vedana which previously, at the point where it was Vijnanapaccaya Namarupa, setting the expectation at that point forward, at that point, at that very point, an expectation was set and immediately there was a feeling of uneasiness. That vexation arose at that point itself. Again, what is vexation in Sinhala? Pelima. Pahe ellima, right? That's the etymology there. Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana Paha Ellima. Now you've clung on to these five. You've now set an expectation on this five. So you're waiting for this five to come into your world. At Vijnana Paccaya Namarupa, you're waiting for that five to come into your world. So when you're waiting, well, who likes to waiting? Who likes to wait? Nobody likes to wait. Queue, who likes a queue? Nobody likes a queue. We don't like to wait, we want it now, instantly. So, even this five, you don't like to wait. So the fact that you have to wait, now that you've created this expectation, is not a pleasurable feeling. That's an unpleasurable feeling. That unpleasurable feeling also you experience through Vedana.
And that was moha. Not raga, not dvesha, that was moha. Delusional. And that moha, that pelima, that vexation, now has the opportunity to be relieved. Because now we are at passa paccaya vedana. At this point where passa or contact has happened, that's where the eye has been opened, sight has come in from the outside world, and it has left a sense impression on the mind, and now you have the rupa-rupa, you have the sanya, which has helped you to identify what this object is that you're looking at. You have the associated action with that. Like I said, chair, sit, food, eat, water, drink. Right? The associated action with that, bed, sleep. These actions which we either attach to or we dislike. At the point where it was vinyana paccaya namrupa, all those actions were associated from the upadana skanda. Because that all came from history, from your memory banks. That's why when I say bed, you think sleep. Why? Upadana. These are all preconceived. Because it's preconceived, now when I give you a new bed, immediately you're going to check, can I sleep on this? Because that's what is already associated with. That's what you've already associated it with. For a young kid, bed, jump. So give a kid a bed, he wants to know if he can jump on it. Give an adult a bed, he or she wants to know if he can sleep on it. Because that's the action, that's the sankara to which there's clinging. That's why it's upadana skanda, clinging aggregates. And it was using that sankara, this nama rupa was produced at vinyana paccaya nama rupa, and now it's the opportunity to relieve from that vexation. So what if you found a bed on which you couldn't sleep? Sapavedana or dukvedana? Dukvedana. What if a young boy found a bed on which you couldn't jump because it wasn't a spring mattress? Sapavedana or dukvedana? Now it's dukvedana. Because it's not just the rupa. What about the sankara? All of this we are attached to. And all this because of wrong view. Either distortion in view, distortion in conception or perception, or distortion in the consciousness. Ditti, sanya or citta vipalyasa. This is distortion. Not true. False. This is why when a young guy sees a girl, again there's rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vinyana, all that are all clinging aggregates according to this as well. Expectations. Through history, through information that this guy knows about a girl. Right? This is he expects a rupa. It has to be this kind of rupa. Again, based on drishti. If a young boy grew up thinking, knowing, learning that a fair girl is a pretty girl, again, it's only drishti. This is all based on view. Are there pretty girls in the outside world? No. Are there ugly girls in the outside world? No, still no. Pretty and ugly does not exist in the outside world. But a view can be given into a person, and this boy grows up thinking that a fair girl is a pretty girl. Now when you say the word girlfriend, what picture comes to mind? She has to be fair. And then, I think in one of the sermons we did at Aranmathini Aramu, I spoke of the dangers of pornography. How when people go online, they go into pornography, and then now they have different expectations of what a woman should be like. Now they expect a completely distorted view. There's a completely distorted expectation. And then when young girls, young women cannot meet that expectation, now they have to go through modifications to their bodies. Changing this, that and the other. Why? Because otherwise there's no way, I'm not able to supply.
My consumer has arrived at the door. He's expecting a size 8. I'm a size 10. So what should I do? Liposuction. See? All to do with setting expectations. Again, consumers and suppliers. See how you have become a consumer now? At the stage of Vijnana Paccaya Nama Rupa, now you set an expectation. Now you have just become a consumer. You're expecting the world to supply. And then at Pasapaccaya Vedana, this is the point at which the world is supplying you. And you are standing at the yard checking if what has been delivered is what you asked for. So you go through your order sheet. Okay, let's see what you've got. I asked fair. What have you brought me? Caucasian. Nah. Don't like. Reject. I asked fair. What have you brought me? Negro. No. I don't like. Reject. See? Where's the problem? Expectation. Where did expectation come from? Drishti. Which is all distortions. Distortion in view, distortion in perception, distortion in consciousness. All that came from someone else who was also distorted in their view, in their perception, or in their consciousness. This is why associating with immoral, ignoble people is super dangerous. So dangerous. Because you don't know what kind of distorted view they might plant in your mind. If you remember from yesterday's sermon that Guru Swami once did, what if that distortion comes in about your mother? A young novice monk today came and asked for some advice. He said, Swami Nuhansa, I'm still reminded of, I think he's only 16. So you can expect these things from a 16-year-old boy. You know, after all, they're only human beings, right? You don't become an arahant the moment you don a robe. I'm not an arahant, so, you know, I can only expect these things from them. You know, hormones running all over the body, and, you know, this is... So it's an age of turmoil. So you have to deal with that accordingly. So he comes and asks me, he says, Swami Nansa, sometimes I'm reminded of the times that I used to spend with my girlfriend. Girlfriends, he says. And sometimes when I go to the Dhanashala, you know, sometimes women come in, young ladies, young girls come in, and I'm reminded of them. What do I do? He said, can you give me some advice, some instructions, so I can fight this battle? Because I want to win this battle. I realize that this is all false. I want to win this battle. Isn't that so great of him? Parents, this is what I ask you to do in your homes. Create an environment where your son can come and tell you about this. Mothers, fathers, create an environment where your son can come and tell you, Mother, today I saw a girl and I felt desire for her. Please help me. But he's only going to do that if he realizes that desire is not a good thing. He's only going to do that if he realizes desire is something dangerous. Because for as long as he thinks desire equals pleasure, well, then he's just going to go after pleasure. Continue to go after desire. That's what he's going to do. So we have an environment like that at the monastery. And I'm so glad that we do. Where young monks can come and speak to the elder monks and say, Swami Nuhansa, this happened to me. Please help me. So when he said that, I said, okay. So there was a girl today, apparently. And he said, when I saw her, I had feelings of desire. So what should I do? I said, there was a table that was just next to us on which someone had left a cap of a water bottle. So it was just left there. So I picked that up and I said, take this. So he took it into his hand. I said, from here on, you should always keep this cap with you. Never lose it. Guard it with your life. He said, why? I said, because this is your karmasthan. This is your meditation object. This is what you need to contemplate on. He said, how? I said, does sensual pleasure exist in the outside object? He said, no, I understand that. He said, so does it exist in the woman? In that girl that you saw this afternoon, does it exist in her? He said, no. Well then, if you are able to look at a woman and have feelings of sensual desire in something that does not have sensual desire, well then surely you should be able to do this with the bottle cap. I said, you know, you're so talented. Look at what you can do. You can look at something, a sight, which does not have beauty, and in your mind you can create beauty. How talented you are. Wow, you're a genius. You know, it's a 16-year-old boy, so this is how I have to tackle it. Psychology all over, right? So I had a younger brother, so I've been through some of these experiences, so I know how to sometimes deal with them. I wouldn't say I know how, always, but sometimes it works. So I'm learning myself through this conversation. So I said, you're a genius whereby you can look at a sight that does not have sensual pleasure as a quality, a characteristic of that object, and in your mind you're able to create it. You, sir, are an artist. You're a wizard. Wow. Like Merlin. So what I want you to do now is, if you are able to look at a woman and create sensual desire in your mind by looking at something that didn't have it, well then from now on, every moment you see that girl or any girl and feel sensual desire within you, put your hand into your pocket, pull out that bottle cap and look at it. And go, surely if I can do it with that girl, I should be able to do it with this. Because does beauty exist in the girl? No. Well, if it doesn't exist in the girl, it cannot exist in the bottle cap. If it exists in the girl, then it should exist in the bottle cap as well. So if it doesn't exist in this, then surely that's a reminder that it does not exist in the girl. So I said, don't lose it. And I made a mark on it, just in case he throws it away and finds a new one. So I said, every now and then I bump into you, I'm going to ask you, show me that bottle cap. Make sure you have it until the day comes whereby you're no longer going to see a girl and have feelings of sensual desire. Because it does not exist. All you're doing is going into a state of mental suffering, mental vexation, and then finding relief from that. It's not the girl that did it for you. If you all think the girl that can do it for you, then sir, this bottle cap should be able to do it for you as well. And then I kind of made fun of it, because I wanted him to see the ridiculous nature of how he was feeling. I said, you know, if you're looking at a girl and go, oh my God, she's so beautiful, then you should be able to look at the bottle cap and go, oh my God, you're so beautiful. Sexy bottle cap. I ridiculed him. Not him. I ridiculed Raga. See, parents, could you not tackle these issues with your children like that? You don't have to tell them off. Show them the ridiculous nature of this desire. Because ultimately it's just trickery. It's foolery. Nothing else. Vinyan is a magician. Show them that this is just magic. There's nothing real. There's no substance behind this. This is just emptiness. Show them that. You don't have to tell them off for it. What if I had addressed it differently? What if I had said, how dare you? A Swamin Mahasaya should never feel like that. Go to the corner of the room and be sorry about yourself for how you felt. Next time, he's not going to come and tell me. Next time he might resort to other means. What if he decides, I can't bear this, I'm going to put my robes away and go back into lay life? What a waste of a young life which is destined to become an arahant. What a waste, right? This is why I say, we have to be intelligent to tackle these problems differently. Be able to accept that your child is just the same like you. If you are a bundle of raga, dvesha, moha walking on two legs, well, what about the child you brought into this world? Surely your child is also just a bundle of raga, dvesha, moha walking on two legs. It should surprise you if your child doesn't feel desire. If he's a boy, looks at a girl, doesn't feel desire. That should worry you. Seriously. Right? A young teenage girl looks at a guy, doesn't have any feelings whatsoever. That should worry you. Someone comes and shouts at your son, says, "You dog," and your child doesn't feel anything. That should worry you. If he's not become an arahant, that should worry you. Because then there's something fundamentally wrong. Either he's lost it. He's gone insane. That needs treatment. So be prepared to accept that your children are a bundle of raga, dvesha, moha walking on two legs just as much as you are. If it's okay for you to feel them, then surely it should be okay for your children to be feeling them. But okaying that, be prepared to accept, but address it. Address it in an intelligent way. Don't be foolish about it. Because if you tell them off, they're not going to come back a second time. If you shout at them, they're not going to come back a second time because they have lost all trust in you. Don't lose your trust. Don't let them lose trust in you, because if they do so, next time they're not going to come to you, but they're going to go to somebody. And that somebody might well ruin their life. So finally, coming back again, it was the relief from that setting the expectation that has brought this pleasure. And that pleasure is felt through Vedana. That's why Vedana Paccaya Tanha in the dependent origination process. But wherever there was Vedana Paccaya Tanha, now the mind does not attach just to the Vedana. Although in the dependent origination process it says Vedana Paccaya Tanha, it's not just the Vedana that the mind is now attached to. It's also the rupa, it's also the sanya, it's also the sankara, it's also the vijnana. But attachment arose primarily due to Vedana, because Vedana was what brought you, enabled you to experience the pleasurable feeling, because that's what Vedana is. It's like you order something online, let's say a pizza, you go online and you order it. The delivery guy brings it to your door. Aren't you really happy to see his face? Oh, thank you, Mr. Delivery Driver. You're so happy to see his face. But he was only one part of it. What about everyone who cooked the pizza? What about the guy who took down the order? What about the guy who made the oven? Who built the shop? All that. You don't feel particularly happy to see them. You're just happy about the delivery guy. Likewise, it's the Vedana that ultimately brought you that pleasurable sensation. But all the other things were involved. Rupa was involved. Sanya was involved. Sankara was involved. And Vijnana were involved. All of these five are involved. But it's the Vedana through which you feel this. That's why Vedana Paccaya Sankara. Vedana Paccaya Tanha. And when you experience that attachment, now, the mind quickly takes toll. Ah, so surely, this rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara and vijnana brought me pleasure. Which means, pleasure exists in the rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vijnana, as well as the rupa, shabda, gandha, rasa, sparsha, dhamma that exists in the outside world. Bahirayatana, abhyantarayatana. External institutes and internal institutes. It was these two that brought me pleasure, so surely pleasure exists in them. No understanding that it was the relief from vexation that is the result of this pleasure. No understanding of that. And then as soon as you experience that attachment, now upadana, moment of attachment, and then continued association with that. Continue to associate. Going around it. It's like a bee flying around a flower. First it smells the smell. A bee first smelled the honey. Now it continues to fly around the flower. And similarly, this is what the mind does. Once that object came in, pleasurable feeling, attachment, and then after attachment, continued association, because this is, for as long as I continue to attach myself with this object, or this person, or this event, I'm going to be able to develop what? Self. Pleasure world. Baby, Natasha. And that's where bhava arises. This is existence. Existence of a being that is associating with that object. And then jati. Now it has come into being. It's really difficult to explain that in English. I'll continue to develop that and see how else I can improvise that. This connection between bhava and jati. You know, this is why I used the example last week of baking a cake. Once you put all the ingredients and put the cake in the oven, now it's going through the process of becoming. And then eventually there's going to be a point at which you go, ah, now it's a cake. That's how this bhava paccaya jati happens. But it happens like that, in one chitta. So whatever jati came into being, now the self has been born, right? This is what this dependent origination process was for after all. To bring forth the self, to produce the self, give rise to baby Natasha. But ultimately, if it was the Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana that brought us this pleasure, what's going to happen to Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana in a moment? It's going to pass away. And when it passes away, now the self passes away. Pleasure world collapses. And then back to Jara, Marana, Shoka, Parideva, Dukkha, Domanasa, Upayasa, Evametasa, Kevalasa, Dukkha, Kandasa, Samudayo Hoti. The Buddha says, this is how Dukkha is born. This is the process. This is the process of how Dukkha comes into your world. For someone who sees this and penetrates that veil of pleasure. The veil of pleasure is, it's Rupa, Shabda, Gandha, Rasa, Sparsha that brought me pleasure. It's Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana that brought me pleasure. Penetrate that. See within and realize that, no, it's not that that brought me pleasure. Like the example I gave you some weeks ago. When you're hungry, what is the reason for hunger, for feeling hunger? It's because? Why do you feel hunger? Why do you feel hunger? Come on, there are doctors in the room. You don't need a doctor for this, but why do you feel hunger? Because your stomach is empty. That's not rocket science. Because your stomach is empty. That's why you feel hunger. And then the gastric juices start coming into your stomach. Right? Then that's when you start to feel hunger. So what do you need to relieve yourself from hunger? Everyone says food. Anything. Absolutely anything. Doesn't have to be food. Put in grass. Is that not going to relieve yourself from hunger? Mud. No? Yes. Sand. Is that food? No. Anything thrown in is going to relieve yourself from hunger. Because hunger is the experience of the stomach being empty. Not the stomach not having food in it. That's not what hunger is. Most people think hunger is the stomach not having food in it. That's not what hunger is. Hunger is the stomach not having anything in it. Being empty. Relief from being empty requires what? Anything. So when the mind is in a state of vexation, anything that can relieve it from that state of vexation will leave the mind in a state of pleasure. It's not the sights or the sounds or the smells or the taste that's responsible for that pleasure. It just happens to be, as if by coincidence, that that is all that can come to relief. There is nothing else that can relieve it. It's a very subtle point, but hope you can understand what I'm trying to get to you. It just happens to be that there is nothing else in this world. Imagine there's only rice in this world.
No other types of food. That's just rice. No curries or nothing. There is nothing. It's just rice. Plain white rice. If it's plain white rice and nothing else that existed in this world, for someone who's hungry, when they eat rice, because that's the only thing that's there, they can very soon come to the conclusion that it's rice that relieves me from hunger. Because there's no other food that they can try out. They think, rice relieves me from hunger. But you know that it's anything that can relieve you from hunger, because there are lots of types of food, and you know that it's not just one particular type of food that relieves you from hunger. But it also happens to be that whenever you felt hungry, the only thing that you put in was food. You didn't put in anything else. Even if it was water or a drink, that was still food. So you come to the conclusion, that's why when I ask you what relieves you from hunger, people say food. Because that's all they're used to. You never put in sand. You never put in red bricks or stones. You never did that. That's why you don't have that experience of being relieved by hunger by throwing anything into it. But if you studied science, you'd know that you feel hunger because the stomach is empty, not because there's no food in it. And likewise, the mind experiences pleasure because it was relieved from vexation. Not because it's lacking Rupa Shabda Gandha Rasa Sparsha Dhamma or Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana. But it just happens to be that these are the only things that can come to relieve it from vexation. That's why. So if that is the case, what is the point in attaching to sight, sound, smell, taste? Because they never relieved you from suffering. Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana, they never relieved you from suffering. They never brought you pleasure. Relief from suffering was the result, or rather pleasure was the result of relief from suffering. That was done by Rupa Shabda Gandha Rasa Sparsha Dhamma, sight, sound, smell, taste and touch, and Dhammas. But it could have been anything. But it just happens to be that they are the only things that can come to your rescue. But it's not them that did it. Subtle point, but try and think about it and hopefully it will make sense. So, what I wanted to get across to you primarily today was, because there was a question last week at the end of the sermon, you know, where does Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, the five clinging aggregates, where do they fit into this picture? So is that clear to you now? Because that Vijnana Paccaya Nama Rupa, when you set that expectation, remember it was a pentagon. In that pentagon you had Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana. And that pentagon, all five sides, you brought from your stores. These stores are your memory banks. And in your memory banks, you brought in the sides, or the Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana that you were already clinging on to. You brought them, created this model, and then at Passapaccaya Vedana, although we only speak of Vedana because that is what brings us the experience of pleasure, there's all other four as well. So it's, if you were to expand Passapaccaya, it would be Passapaccaya Rupa, Passapaccaya Vedana, Passapaccaya Sankara, Passapaccaya Sanya, Passapaccaya Vijnana. All five would be there. But the experience of pleasure is through Vedana. And that is why it's Vedana Paccaya Tanha. But all other four are also there at the same time. A mind that is ignorant comes to the conclusion that it's these five that brought me that pleasurable sensation. Therefore, what should I do? Make a note of it for future. And then you cling on to it once again and then put it back into your memory banks in the expectation of a future. And the being goes on and on and on in samsara. Do you see how, without an understanding of the dependent origination process, you are never going to be able to break through this? Without an understanding of how it's vexation and the relief from vexation that brings pleasure, you are never going to be able to do this? Break through the shackles of samsara? Because for as long as you are ignorant of that, we are going to continue to attach ourselves to the outside world. The outside world that never brought us anything, that never brought us pleasure, continue to attach to it. Nothing. Pointless, meaningless, futile, essenceless. So contemplate on that. Continue to reflect on that. When you experience moments of pleasure,
take a moment to contemplate, take a moment to reflect. You don't need to deal with mental pain. Deal with mental pleasure, and then the pain will go away. Did you all get that? Don't worry about the pain. Deal with the pleasure, and then the pain will go away. Because it's the pleasure that eventually brought you the pain. It's the pleasure that eventually brings you the pain. For as long as you seek pleasure, you find pleasure, you experience pleasure in the outside world, sights, sounds, smells, tastes and touch, you are going to continue to attach to them. And every time you're going to continue to attach to them, they're going to bring you suffering. So deal with that side, the rest will be sorted out automatically. Try to fix this problem, that's never going to go away. Thank heavens we found the Buddha, right? No, not thank heavens. Thank the Buddha we gone found the Buddha. If it wasn't for him, how would we know any of this? We'd be ignorant, continuing our journey in samsara. So, take the time, reflect. Every time you experience pleasure, you have something practical to do now. Don't just listen to these sermons and go home and it's just another day, another week, and then come back. That's pointless. Because that's not how I spend my week. That's not how I give advice to other novice monks who try to practice the path. Because we're all trying to walk the Noble Eightfold Path in the hope that we can end this journey someday. The fun is not in going on the journey. The fun is getting to the end of the journey. If walking on this path is so much fun, well, how fun do you think it's going to be at the end of this? So let's get there as soon as we possibly can. Like it's going out of fashion. Attain Nibbana like it's going out of fashion. Put out vexation like it's going out of fashion. Like there's no tomorrow. Be honest. Put every ounce of energy you have into it. And you will succeed. There's no doubt. I always remind you, and I shall do so again finally. You are all very fortunate people. You are extremely fortunate people. I have no words to say that, to explain how fortunate you are. Not because you have come along to this sermon, but because you have received the gift of the Dhamma. You have been born in a time where the Supreme Buddha is around. There are some of you here who are about the age of my parents. But unfortunately, my parents have not been fortunate enough to receive this Dhamma. They're not interested. They seek happiness elsewhere. How lucky do you think you are? I can't speak to them like this. They're not prepared to listen. They want to talk to me. I listen. But they're not prepared to listen to what I have to say. Well, the day might come where they're prepared to. But, you know, when I see some of you who are about the age of my mother, my father, and I think, if only my parents were so lucky, if only my parents were so fortunate, if only my parents had this opportunity, but they don't. So I feel sorry for them. So make the most of it. Make it your firm resolve to not have to keep coming back here. I'm sick and tired of seeing your faces. Every week after week. Don't you have anything better to do? It's just a joke, okay? But you know what I mean, right? Let's get to the end of this journey. If the journey is so much fun, then the end, you can only begin to imagine. Okay, so we'll conclude the sermon there then.
Okay, I think it's the Sinhala Arya Maitri today. Yes, okay. So we chant the Arya Maitri for a few moments and then we'll transfer merits and we'll conclude.
Mamad siyalu loka siyalu satnayo sansara dahayen midetma sansara rogayen midetma sansara anduren midetma sansara ginnen midetma nibbana parama sukhayen sukhita tarvetva nibbana parama sukhayen sukhita tarvetva nibbana parama sukhayen sukhita tarvetva mamada siyalu loka siyalu satvayo රාග බන්ධනයෙන් මිදෙත්වා ද්වේෂ බන්ධනයෙන් මිදෙත්වා මෝහ බන්ධනයෙන් මිදෙත්වා මාර බන්ධනයෙන් මිදෙත්වා නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුඛිත තර වෙත්වා නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුඛිත තර වෙත්වා නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුඛිත තර වෙත්වා මමද සියලු ලෝක සියලු සත්වයෝ ජාති ගින්නෙන් මිදෙත්වා ජරා ගින්නෙන් මිදෙත්වා ව්‍යාධි ගින්නෙන් මිදෙත්වා මරණ ගින්නෙන් මිදෙත්වා නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුඛිත තර වෙත්වා නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුඛිත තර වෙත්වා නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුඛිත තර වෙත්වා මමද සියලු ලෝක සියලු සත්වයෝ ශෝක ගින්නෙන් මිදෙත්වා පරිදේවයෙන් මිදෙත්වා දුක්ඛ ගින්නෙන් මිදෙත්වා දෝමනස්සයෙන් මිදෙත්වා උපායාසයෙන් මිදෙත්වා යම් පිච්චං නලබති තම්පි දුක්ඛයෙන් මිදෙත්වා සංකිත්තේන පංචෝපාදානඛණ්ඩයෙන් මිදෙත්වා නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුඛිත තර වෙත්වා නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුඛිත තර වෙත්වා නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුඛිත තර වෙත්වා කාම ලෝක අනාතයි එයින් මිදෙත්වා රූප ලෝක අනාතයි එයින් මිදෙත්වා අරූප ලෝක අනාතයි එයින් මිදෙත්වා සියලු ලෝක අනාතයි එයින් මිදෙත්වා අතහැරීම නාතයි අතහැරීම වෙත්වා නොඇල්ම නාතයි
noyalma vitnva midima natai midima vitnva nivanama natai nivanama 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 vitnva. Natti me saranam anyam buddho me saranam varam. Natti me saranam anyam dhammo me saranam varam. Natti me saranam anyam sangho me saranam varam. Natti me saranam anyam nibbanam paramam sukham.
Okay. One more thing I would suggest to his parents is find a moment in your children's daily routine for them to practice the Arya Maitreya. Even if it's 5 minutes, it's very powerful. It will do amazing wonders to them that you will not regret. Recently, a young couple contacted me and they informed me that before they had a child, they decided that we were going to bring a child into this world and offer him to the Sambuddha Shasana. Even before they decided to make a child, this was their firm resolve. But a year after the child was born, the parents found out that this child has some kind of neurological disorder. And now they were upset. They were wondering if we were still able to ordain this child in due course. And at that time I said, well, you know, let's let time deal with this. Continue to seek medical advice as best as you can. But there was one thing that this father told with me that I found particularly, that really struck a chord with me. And he said, from the day that the mother got pregnant, every day he would sit by the mother and chant the Arya Maitreya to the baby child that was not even born. And he continued to do this every day. And then from the day the baby was born, the father and mother continued to do this for the child. And so the parents were asking me, is there anything else we need to do from our side apart from seeking medical advice? I said, no, just continue doing what you're doing. Because there are certain things that karma bring to us that we can't avoid. It's the karmas that we've done, whose rewards, whose fruit that we have to bear. But if there's any protection that you can give to your children, to yourself, the Arya Maitreya is one of the best that you can find. So continue to do that with your children. Even as a family, if you can find every evening, just take 5 minutes. I know a lot of families who do that. Like Christians who sit around the table and they do thanksgiving. They say grace before they take their meals. They thank God for this food that they have received. Well, likewise, why can't we do something similar? I think all Buddhists, in their right minds, who have a firm resolve to attain Nibbana, even if it's just 5 minutes before meal time. Everyone get together, sit on the sofa, sit on the seat, grab a chair somewhere. Do Arya Maitri for 5 minutes. Make it a routine, make it a practice every day. And then before long it will become a habit. And then the energy that you will be able to draw from that, the power that you will gain from that, those who will have done it will know. And I know there are among you those who have, and those who have come and shared with me their experiences. If you do it, then you know the power of it. If you don't, well, of course, then you don't. So do it. Okay. So with that, we'll conclude the sermon then. Before we do so, let us take a moment to transfer merits to all those who deserve the merits. First and foremost, as we did at the beginning, let us take a moment to appreciate the fact that it is the supremely enlightened Samma Sambuddhajanana Vahanse who it is that we have to thank for his infinite sacrifice, his infinite compassion, his infinite wisdom, because of which today we have the gift of Dhamma. It is because he sacrificed himself in countless times in samsara for the deliverance of all sentient beings that we have the gift of Dhamma today. And also, as well as the bhikkhu bhikkhunis upasaka upasikas who since time immemorial protected and preserved the Dhamma in the form of the Tripitaka and passed it down to us through our ancestors and ultimately down to us. And today we have the opportunity to study the texts to understand and comprehend the four noble truths and the path to Nibbana. So may the merits that we have all acquired in the meritorious deed that we have done today, in not just listening to this sermon but also in any and all meritorious deeds that you might have all engaged in throughout the start of the day, as well as offering flowers to the Buddha, lighting incense sticks, lighting oil lamps and so on and so forth, or any and all merits that we have all acquired today, may through the power of these merits, the bhikkhu bhikkhunis upasaka upasikas who made it their lifelong ambition to pass down this gift of Dhamma to all for the deliverance of all sentient beings be able to rejoice in these merits. If any of them have been born in the woeful plains, may through the power of these merits they be able to redeem themselves from those woeful plains, abstain from their meritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, and fulfill the noble eightfold path and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Also, let's take a moment to transfer merits to all the members of the Mahasangha, the Mahanayakas, the Anunayakas, as well as all those members of the Mahasangha who do an immense service towards the Buddha Shasane and to protecting and preserving the Buddha Shasane for the benefit of all beings in the present and in the future. May they all also be able to rejoice in these merits. Also take a moment to remind yourselves about the incumbent monks in your local temples and nunneries and the nuns in your local nunneries. Although you have come along today, ladies and gentlemen, to listen to a sermon, perhaps offer flowers and so on and so forth, it is those monks and nuns who are in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, through rain and shine. It is they who have been there to support you, to guide you, and also give you a child education in the Dhammapassana and so on. So, let us take a moment to pass on the merits that we have all acquired today to them as well. May, through the power of these merits, they all be able to abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Also, let us take a moment to transfer merits to the devas, Brahma, spirits, demons, and the dead that we invited at the start of this sermon. Anyone who might have helped you, assisted you, supported you in any way, shape, or form, mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, uncles, aunts, nephews, and so on and so forth, whatever contribution they might have had to your well-being, let us take a moment to transfer those merits to them. If any of them have today been born in the woeful plains, may through the power of these merits they be able to be born in the blissful plain, may through the power of these merits they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Also, let's take a moment to transfer merits to your parents who are your parents in this birth, whether they are alive today or have predeceased you, as well as your teachers in this birth, as well as in your previous births, anyone and everyone who might have been a parent to you, anyone and everyone who might have been a teacher to you. It is thanks to them that today you have grown up to be law-abiding citizens of this country. It is because of them that today you are in a situation, in a suitably comfortable situation whereby you have the freedom, you have the time, you have the facilities to be able to come along and listen to these sermons be able to understand these sermons, the wisdom, the knowledge to understand these sermons. So just take a moment to transfer those merits to them as well. If any of them have been born in the woeful plains, made through the power of these merits, they'll be able to redeem themselves from the woeful plains, abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Also, let's take a moment to transfer merits to all those who made this event possible. Anyone who might have invited you to be here today, anyone who might have offered you a transport, anyone who might have taken on your burden, your responsibilities of your family or perhaps your businesses, your enterprises, your workplaces, those who might have stayed behind just to enable you to be here today, let us take a moment to transfer merits to them as well. Also, anyone who might have offered you transport to be here today or perhaps might have washed and ironed your clothes and offered them to you to dress yourself up so that you can come along and listen to these sermons. Or those perhaps who might have offered you a meal so that you could sate your hunger, so that you could quench your thirst and therefore listen to this sermon comfortably in a suitable and fitting environment. As well as those who might have offered you a seat or perhaps offered you a glass of water or perhaps by arranging the facilities for your comfort and your listening pleasure. May they all be able to rejoice in these merits. For all those who might have predeceased us, who were in any way, shape or form responsible for or contributed to any of those facilities, any of those luxuries, any of those comforts, if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, made through the merits that we have all acquired today, they'll be able to redeem themselves from those woeful plains, be able to abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Also, let's take a moment to transfer merits to the members of the armed forces who fought a 30-year-old long battle in Sri Lanka, those who lost their lives and sacrificed their lives for our well-being to protect and preserve the peace and harmony of this country. Let us take a moment to transfer merits to them as well as the members of the police force, as well as those who might have lost their lives, be they friend or foe, if any of them are looking for merits. May through the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plane, may they be able to abstain, may they be able to redeem themselves from the woeful planes, be born in the blissful planes. May through the power of these merits, they be able to abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Also, let's take a moment to transfer merits to those people who are involved and engaged in leading this country, those people who are involved and engaged in developing and cultivating this country, and those people who are involved and engaged in protecting this country, this nation. If not for them, ladies and gentlemen, you and I will have to be leading this country. You and I will have to be protecting this country. You and I will have to be developing and cultivating this country. It is thanks to them that today we have the freedom, we have the luxury of time to be able to present here today in peace and harmony and to listen to this sermon and to develop our path towards Nibbana. So, may through the power of these merits that we have all acquired today, they be able to rejoice in these merits, they be able to abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, once again, take a moment to remind yourselves of all the meritorious deeds that you may have conducted throughout the day today, offering flowers to the Buddha, offering incense sticks, making your marks of reverence to the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha, as well as listening to this sermon possible, making this event possible, making these facilities available to all those who are able to come along and listen to this sermon. May through all the merits that we have all acquired today in preaching this sermon, listening to this sermon, or in any way, shape or form, contributing to the success of this sermon, success of this meritorious deed, compound and aggregate and help all those beings throughout the world who are eagerly, earnestly and fervently practicing and developing the path, be able to attain the state of arahanthood in this very birth itself, and may, through energizing and empowering them, we be able to witness many hundreds of thousands of arahatunvahanses in this blessed land, in our very lives itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may you and I and everyone and anyone who might have been involved in making this event possible, in making this event happen, be able to become one of those arahatun vahanses, be able to become one of those arahat mehinin vahanses in the era of the Gautama Samma Sambrujanan vahanse itself, in this very life itself. May the noble triple gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you.
Raga ginnen midatva Deshaginneng midetnva Mohaginneng midetnva Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva. Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva. Mamada siyalu loka siyalu satnvayo. Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva. Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva. Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva.
තුන්රුවන්ගේ සුවිසි අනන්ත මහා ගුණ බෙලෙන් සියලු ලෝක සියලු සත්වයෝම නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුඛිතතර වෙත්වා. සාදු සාදු සාදු. May I and all beings in all worlds be freed from the fires of desire, freed from the fires of delusion, freed from the fires of aversion, freed from the fires of delusion. May I and all beings in all worlds attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.